Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to open the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care and Human Services.
I'd like to open the House Committee on Health Care. We're going to have some informational stuff today. Senator Monica Sanders and I are going to switch back and forth with the gavel whenever we feel we need to do it. And we are going to give... Rocky never has an opportunity to talk around this building, so we're going to give him a special opportunity. Senator Monica Sanders and I both ask if you'll hold the questions till we finish the basic part of the presentation, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. This is, I wasn't kidding about the third act. Rocky and staff have been presenting to the Audit Committee at 11 to a special group of legislators at 1 and is now back for the finale. So I hope you save the fireworks for the finale, Rocky. You're on.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I am the Executive Director for Cover Oregon. I started to say thank you for having me here today.
I'd like to say thank you, but I won't.
As I told the Climate Committee this morning, I've got a lot of family members in back that are ready to throw things, so please be kind. I wish I was here with better news that I'm going to provide you today, but while there's going to be some things that we're all concerned about, especially me, especially the governor, especially our board and a variety of our partners and Oregon citizens, there is some good news. We're open for business. We're taking applications. We're processing those manually. It's kind of half manual, half. We've implemented our eligibility system in-house so that we're able to actually process eligibility in-house. We have over 24,000 applications that have been submitted, the majority of those, obviously, over the last couple weeks. And we have last week started really determining the eligibility, bringing on the staff, both on the OHA and the Cover Oregon side, to perform those tasks. And we do have people that have been determined eligible, both for commercial market and Medicaid, who are in the process now of either selecting a plan to be enrolled, or in the case of Medicaid and Healthy Kids, those names have been provided, the information provided to the Oregon Health Authority, who is auto-enrolling those folks into Medicaid. So I won't go into specific numbers on those people right now, although it's in the about 2,000 applications. I don't know if that's 2,000 people or 3,000 people, because an application may have two people or three or what, but I will guarantee you that we will show some enrollments on the sheets at the end of this month when we are due to report where we are in November. So while I'm going to talk about some of the problems and challenges, I want you to know that we're hard at work. A lot of staff are putting their heart and soul into this, as well as community partners and agents and carriers, too, assisting us to try to get anybody who wants coverage for January 1. We're doing our best to get them through this system so that they can have that choice. I want to kind of step back and remember that we have 560,000 Oregonians uninsured through the Fast Track system in Medicaid. We've already been able to insure about 12% of those folks. We have over 70,000 that we've put in Medicaid in the last 6 weeks. So we've actually made a pretty good dent in the uninsured population as a state, not necessarily just Cover Oregon or Cover Oregon, but as a state. The vision was the health of Oregonians long term. This isn't just about January 1 or October 1 or March 31st. This is really about over the next 2 or 3 years, being able to get people into the right plans and the right coverage and make the kinds of adjustments that we need to make to ensure that all Oregonians have access to coverage. We'll talk about SHOP a little bit down here. I'm going to skip through a lot of slides. Otherwise, I will take all of the time on the slides and we'll make sure that we have have some good time for questions. As most of you know, we have 11 medical carriers in the individual market that are participating. This compares, for example, to the state of Washington that has 3. We have 8 small group carriers that will participate when we get the small employer program going. And that compares, for example, to the state of Washington that has 1 carrier in 3 counties. And we have also, through this process, we believe, and as does the insurance division who reviews rates, the competition has worked. We have some of the lowest rates of the 18 major cities, and we're probably in the bottom 5 or 6 overall in terms of our health insurance rates, and we believe that has a lot to do with the competitive market that we've established, first in the outside market, but also through Cover Oregon. Just to kind of put out there, and the first question I'm always asked is, you know, why are you where you are from a technology standpoint? And the easy answer to that is scope. We tried to take on more in terms of the vision in what our exchange marketplace, they wanted us to look like. We took on more than any other state. California doesn't do Medicaid. Single option, 3 counties for the small employer program in the state of Washington. Kentucky, which is probably one of the best success stories around, already had their Medicaid built, their whole Medicaid eligibility online and built. So for Oregon, we were really starting from scratch. And that's one of the reasons we got a very sizable amount of dollars, because it wasn't spread over 3 or 4 projects. It was really put into 1 project. If I could do it over again, I would probably lay out that scope differently and bring it in at different stages rather than shoot it all for October 1st. But that's a decision that would have had to have been made over 2 years ago, and we didn't have the luxury of reviewing that until just recently. But that is just, bottom line, it is because of the scope and the job we took on. 4 to 5 year project in 2.5 years, and the system isn't broken. It's only just not finished, and we'll get into that a little bit. Overall timelines, open enrollment, as you know, began on October 1st. We have put out press releases and started through our website and with our partners messaging that from a paper process or electronic submission process, people need to get their applications in as soon as possible. December 4th is somewhat of a cutoff for us to be able to determine eligibility for commercial plans, get the information back to those individuals so they can select the plan and get enrolled by January 1. Only if they want to use Cover Oregon, they still have the option, as people are doing every day, of going outside of Cover Oregon and going straight to carriers. December 15th is the deadline for getting plan selection data back to us. That was established by the federal government, where all states are in negotiations with the federal government to try to extend that, but at this point, it remains at December 15th. January 1 is the first time coverage can begin. So we never anticipated that a lot of people would come in October and November. First part of November, we really thought that we would start seeing some ramp up in late November, early January. But most of our enrollments, we've always predicted, would come in March of next year, which is the last date of open enrollment, or last month of open enrollment. So that's the website, what I'm going to show you. A lot of people think we're not up. I'm not going to go through the website because of time, but you can go to our website. And on that website, you can browse plans, and it's pretty neat. You can put in your information, how old you are, where you live, how many members in your household, whether you're tribal or not, and hit that sort button, and up comes the plans that are available to you. In the site currently, you can sort by price, you can sort by quality stars, and we're one of the few states that are using quality indicators for our plans. And then you can pick and compare up to, I'm not sure, it's 3 or 5 plans at a time, and the next step will be obviously being able to say that's the one I want, and that's the system piece that'll come in the next month. So you can go browse plans, and I will tell you, people are doing that today. We have between 400 and 500,000 unique visitors to our website. Carriers tell us people are coming to them after seeing which plans they wanted on the website, and those people that aren't eligible for tax credits are enrolling directly with plans today utilizing the information we provide. The Find Help, which is in the middle, you go in and press in your zip code or your city, and you can get an agent or a community partner that's near you that can help you through that application process. So we have access to help. Pull up their phone numbers, addresses. Apply now is you press that, it brings up the application. You can fill that out online, download it if you want, or you can fill it out online and press submit, and that is submitted to us so that we now can determine eligibility electronically in our customer service center. So those things are there now, as well as a whole bunch of other information that's kind of at the bottom of this page that you don't see. You'll also hear that we're doing 5 application fairs starting, I think, today in Medford, where we have over 200 people coming into an application fair. We've got over 400, I think, registered in one day in Portland. So people are starting to come in and to do their applications utilizing some of our staff for assistance.
Mr. Chair?
This is kind of what the...
Real quick. As he goes through this, could we ask some questions
We were going to wait for the end, if that's okay.
Because there's some of the stuff that he's kind of hitting on, you know, with 400,000 to 500,000 people that have visited there. How come no one signed up? Questions like that we kind of have as he's going through,
I think. I would hope you would hang on to the questions, and you'll get the first question when we're done.
I might have 20 by the time he's done.
Well, we'll give you a couple.
Okay. Mr. Chair, usually I have 30 when I'm done, so we're in the same boat. These are just some pictures of the pages of that website that I just put up there. Again, coveroregon.com, you can go there now. This is for a young person, obviously, that does not qualify for tax credit, and just shows how that comes up and how you can sort it by bronze level, star rating, price, variety of ways. You pick compare, and then when you hit compare, it brings them all up so you can look at all the benefits underneath those. So now I want to go through the update on the IT side. So in May of 2013, we took over the management of the Oracle contract and the management of the IT contract. As you know, prior to that, it was being managed by OHA. And I want to say that's kind of the lead, but we have always been somewhat integrated and working together, obviously. But in May of this last year, we took over full responsibility for the management of this IT project. In August of this year, we had made a decision based on where we were on the bill to only launch to agents and community partners initially. It was called a soft launch. That was based on kind of our thought of where the system would be. However, in September, when I did a full review of the site and looked at its deficiencies and good parts and bad parts, I chose to delay an October 1st deadline, and we then began working and putting our contingency process in place to hire people to bring them on so that we could do a manual process until we got the IT piece going. I'll give you some other dates down the road, but it was a tough decision to not go forward. Our state of Washington went forward. In the first month, the 8,000 people that were found eligible for tax credits were found eligible for the wrong tax credit. And when we did our testing on that, we saw too many errors like that and chose not to go. I received a lot of criticism for that. I will take that heat, but we decided and have since decided not to put it out there until it gave accurate determinations of eligibility. Another state, for the first 2 weeks, everybody was found ineligible for tax credits because they had a program error that said they were incarcerated. You don't hear about those in the news, but we decided that we just didn't want that kind of quality to come out. I would rather be late and right than early and having to deal with thousands of people who thought they were buying insurance that either they were getting tax credit for that they may not have been eligible for. So we delayed this and put really the process in place to do the contingency plans. The IT program is complex, but it's not broken. It's just not finished, and I want to stress that. This is not a blow-up. It's just not finished. Again, five-year project, 2.5 years, and we're 3 months late. And that's just the reality of where we are. Our systems and processes are secure. We meet the federal requirements for that. But what we were missing was last May, June, and July, we should have been doing massive testing of this system, both in user acceptance, system integration, performance testing. This is what you hear about the Fed site. You couldn't get 10,000 people through the site. They'd get to this little hallway and jam up. That's performance testing. We just weren't able to do that. And then we also wanted to make sure from a security standpoint that we had all that done. It wasn't done, and that's why we kind of got to the spot we are. I'm going to skip these, and I think they're in the presentation. We can come back to them, but they just show what's working and what's in progress for the individual market, the tribal, and the tribal is red not because of priority. It's because tribes have different benefits, different cost sharing, different premiums, different access in and out, and it really has to be laid over the exchange once it's built. So I've had to kind of hold off finishing the tribal until I finish the individual non-tribal portion of the exchange. The employer piece, what's complete, what's in progress. The employee piece, what's complete, what's in progress. And again, that information is on the presentation, and I'd be happy to come back and answer questions. Community partners and agents, everything but really a small dashboard to help them manage some of their accounts. Right now, an agent can go on, set up an agent account, and list out all the people that they may have enrolled through Cover Oregon. So we just want to refine that dashboard to give them better ability to manage the enrollments they have through us. Customer service is probably the most robust that we have in place. Carriers, rate benefit validation, small group quote, provider directories. We have three areas that we're still working on with them. The bottom one, which is a critical one, enrollment, is projected to be released on next Saturday. So we're close on some of these. Interfaces, CMS interfaces, SURF interfaces, Medicaid verification, bank transactions, and this includes also access to the federal hub for IRS, Homeland Security. All those are basically built and complete, tested, and work. What's not working quite yet is we have some final things around Medicaid enrollment to make sure that is seamless, and also we have an option to check on people's income status, verification of income through the Employment Department, and that has not been finished. Right now we use the IRS. That's working. Employment Department was only a backup. Global functions, counts, internal billing, Medicaid verification. So if somebody comes in, we're able to check to make sure they're not eligible or already enrolled in Medicaid or message center, document center. All of those are there. The in progress on the global or environments and system integration are IT oriented. So how do we select Oracle? That was done by OHA through the state contracting and procurement process. There were two bidders, and Oracle was chosen by the Oregon Health Authority back in, I believe, May of 2011. When we took over the project in May of this year, the first thing we did was in-depth code analysis to really see what the quality of work was that they were doing. We found some significant deficiencies and started working with Oracle to remedy those problems. Since that time, we also escalated to the highest levels of Oracle, both senior VPs over the summer, requiring on-site VP management of the program, not just the day-to-day workers, but really some project management. We reorganized the development approach and tried to break down the silos that were being created, both with our contractors and to some degree even within Cover Oregon. And I want to say that most of you know who Larry Ellison is, who is the founder and major stockholder of Oracle and chair of the board. I will tell you that he is personally involved in this project at this point, thanks to some push on, a little push on my side, but more of a push on the congressional delegation and the governor's side. Mr. Ellison has designated a senior person that reports to him to be on the ground to manage this project, and it is one of the founding members of Oracle, senior architect, that is now taken over the management of the Oracle project. They have expressed their dismay and apologies and embarrassment for what has so far occurred over this last 6 months or so with us with this project. The other thing that we've started doing is some informal discussions with them, and I say informal because we have not brought the lawyers to the table at this point, but to really talk about performance under the warranties and conditions, performance requirements of the contract. We have exercised a withhold since we took over the contract in May of 5% that we've indicated to them that we would not pay. And we are pretty serious about having some of these discussions because we do not feel we should have to pay for what they didn't fix right. And they have indicated the willingness to sit down. All of the staff that they are bringing on and the A-team and senior management are at no cost to us. That was agreed to before they even did this. So we're really talking about those other costs. So we're, I don't want to throw and point fingers because you can point fingers at me, we can point fingers at a lot of people, but I will tell you from the senior management, the CEO of Oracle, the major stockholder, Larry Ellison, have their focus right now on getting this to work. So the original development time was system development and testing, which was supposed to occur by May of this year. And then in UAT, user acceptance testing, was to occur starting in May through June. Within internal testing and training folks with a October 1st deadline. We were not able to test this system. When we got it in May and really kind of started doing our code reviews, one of the things that we found, and I use this example, picture a train track, model train track circle. And to test that track, you put an engine on there and you send it around. And there are some little track sections where the electricity doesn't work right and the thing slows down. Or there's some dirty track, or there's track that's not put into the baseboard so everything wobbles. The whole idea of testing is to send that train around to identify each of those defects. What we found is we couldn't test during the summer months because there were sections of the track missing. So you'd start the train off and you'd go 2 feet and the track was gone, you had to stop the train. So we were never able to do what we call end-to-end testing. You know, somebody sit down, set up their account, do the eligibility, do the plan shopping, go into enrollment, pick their plans, and send that information to the carrier. We couldn't do it because there were pieces missing in those processes. That's what put us behind. That's why in September, when they finally got those tracks laid, I had to say, no, we're not going forward because we just hadn't done the testing yet. So functional delivery time right now from October, we're originally told, condition of the contract, October 1st, have full shop, individual market. They did not meet that, nor did we meet that deadline, other than the manual process for the individual. Then the second date they gave us was let's at least put up the eligibility piece so that we can do back-end eligibility electronically. They did not meet, nor did we meet that deadline. They came to the board on October 7th, they meeting our vendors, and committed to having the system up and running by October 30th. About mid-October, they informed me they would not be able to meet that deadline. We informed the board. They again appeared with me at the board meeting on November last Thursday, and provided us with their senior leadership approval and oversight, the target dates that you see up there, which is primarily October 25th, so that we can do the back-end enrollment data sharing.
November
25th, yes. December 9th, full end-to-end functionality for community partners and agents so that they can go account setup, eligibility, plan shopping, and enrollment, but just with our community partners and agents on December 9th with full public launch on December 16th. That's their target. That's what everybody's zeroing in on. It's laser focused. We can't add to things that we want them to do until they get that up, and they've committed to giving us at least that basic functionality that we can have on December 16th. I no longer hope. I've taken that word out of my language. When I see it, I'll believe it. And until that time, I will bring on whatever resources are necessary and do whatever I can to make sure that Oregonians can get coverage, find their eligibility for the tax credit, enroll in the Medicaid, and we'll do that through a manual process. So getting enrollment is what matters. Here's kind of how it works. You fill out an application and send to Oregon. You can do that through a PDF file. You can do that through an agent. You can do that online. Hit submit. We'll determine eligibility for tax credits, OHP, and Medicaid. If you are Healthy Kids, if you're OHP or Healthy Kids, that immediately is sent over to OHA, who will auto-enroll those folks. And we've already started that process. A number of people are in over there now, and people, I should say. The electronic files are there, and they will be auto-enrolled in Medicaid. If it is for tax credits, or if it's someone who wants to purchase through us and not get a tax credit, we send out to them an enrollment form, plan selection packet, where they go to our website, use an agent, community partner, or direct, or call our customer service. We help them sort through the plans. They sort through the plans. They rate right down Pacific Source Plan X, whatever it is. It has the information about their tax credits on that plan selection document, so they know what their net cost is going to be. They return that to us, we enter it, and then electronically pass that to the carriers. So that's kind of the way the system is working today, and obviously we hope that'll be full electronic soon. Outreach grants, I won't go into that. We have a lot of relationships with a lot of organizations. I want to remind everybody again, the fast track enrollment's working. We have sent over 260,000 letters out. Approximately a little over 70,000 have returned those. Have indicated that they want to enroll in Medicaid. Dr. Goldberg will probably talk about that a little bit when he's up here. It has been an absolute success for really getting a whole bunch of people coverage on January 1 that 6 weeks ago had nothing. And there's great individual stories that we can tell you about people going through that process. So it's been very successful. Application fairs, Medford, Eugene, Bend, Portland, and Salem. Those are the ones that we're doing right now. We have staff there getting those applications in Medford today. Updating our projections. Right now we have about 24,000 applications that are in hand. Large number of those are missing information. We're working through those and have the last week or two, sending letters out, contacting people. This figure is not quite right. We have about 2,000 determinations we've done. That's applications, not people. And I can't tell you how many people that is right now. In addition, we have agents who have set up approximately 4,200 electric accounts, so they've already started downloading the information on individuals so that we'll be able to do the eligibility determination on those. Again, 40,000 calls to the customer service center, 470,000 unique visitors to our website, which has been, and most of those, the 98% are visitors from Oregon. They're not from all over the country.
I'm sorry, can I, on that slide, which one of those numbers relates to enrollment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, no enrollment figures are here at this point. We've done the determination, so they've been sent over to OHA for enrollment. That's electronically. Or packets have been sent out saying, please select your plan. A number of packets have been returned. I don't have the figures on those at this point because they just started going out last week. I know there are packets back. I don't know how many individuals yet have enrolled, but I will tell you that November 31st, we have enrollments. There will be. Will they be at the level we want? Of course not, but there will be enrollments. Projections, as you know, the president announced last week that they're extending an offer to states that if they want to extend coverage in existing plans beyond January 1st, they can do so at carrier option. The Governor Kitzhaber and Laura Calley, our insurance commissioner, made the determination to give carriers the option to extend current plans that are not ACA compliant, not subject to the benefit requirements, not subject to the consumer protection requirements, but if they want to extend those, a carrier may choose to do that. There are a lot of conditions and details to that. Carriers have until Friday to make that determination and notify the insurance division. It will be posted Friday. And the following week, they have to notify all their individuals enrolled, in the individual market, small group market, to let them know of that election.
Rocky, or Mr. Chair, this is actually something that's been burning on me, is this issue right here. Is the extending the plans, can I follow up on?
Let's let Rocky finish.
Because it's a liability issue. Is it going to be the state liable for it, or is it going to be the federal mandate, because the law hasn't changed there. Is the state going to be liable, or the insurance company going to be liable for us extending that?
Let's let Mr. Chair finish.
So the details
we'll
of that.
A couple of questions to pick out to get started.
The details of that, Mr. Chair, I would have to defer to Laura Calley, though, of the insurance division, who manages that piece on that. But it could have some initial, this year, impact on our enrollments if people elected to keep those plans, if they weren't eligible, for example, for tax credits. So that could have some impact on enrollment. I think we're finding nationally that enrollments are, 10 to 20% of what some of the initial projections were. We're in the process of revising those because our website isn't up and operating the way we want it to operate. It's a manual process. We envision that the numbers will be significantly lower than what we originally anticipated at the beginning. But whether next year we see making most of those up, because you have to go through open enrollment again in October. And again, you can't get a tax credit unless you go through Cover Oregon. And if we have the site up and operational, I think you'll see what we projected, that most of the enrollments the first year are going to come in January, February, and March. They're not going to come January 1. The other thing I want to say here is I think it's important. OMIP population, Dr. Goldberg and OHA are zeroing in on the OMIP population. We are going to make sure that those folks, they have already been sent applications, they've been sent letters, it's been in their newsletters, they've done robocalls once or twice now, because that truly is the only population in Oregon that loses coverage. All those people in the individual market where you say their insurance is being canceled, that's not a correct way of saying it. What's happened to those folks is the plan they're enrolled with, we'll say with Blue Cross, is being discontinued. But every carrier except one who has 300 people in the individual market identified the closest plan that they were currently enrolled in and is automatically enrolling them in that plan. So if you have an individual plan with Pacific Source, Kaiser, Blue Cross, whoever, and don't take any action, you have coverage on January 1, and you'll be billed based on the cost of that plan that they selected you for you, which is supposed to be the most close to what you currently have. So in Oregon, it's a little different than maybe what some of the other parts of the state have. OMIP is not that case, and that's why OHA and Cover Oregon are working jointly to make sure that those folks get that coverage by January 1. These are some enrollment comparisons. I will tell you, they're really tentative. I wouldn't hang my hat on these until we really see what happens over these next 30 days. I want to remind everybody, it's federal grant funds through 2014. There's no state funding. 2015, we have to be self-sufficient. That's based on the administrative fees of carriers and state programs based on enrollments. Again, we're in current contract negotiations, and we've hired staff, again, for really helping us through this non-portal site application process. It's not totally paper, obviously, anymore. That was our original grant amount that we've received, the 244, of which 226 is really what we call our level 2 grant that we're operating off of now. This there's an error in the slide.
Rocky,
but
were you wrap it up.
Okay, two more here. There's an error in this slide. A lot of people say, where are you on your budget as at the end of September? Even with the IT costs, this is accrued, not paid. We were $3.3 million. However, in the month of October, we expended that to where we're at about a $1.7 million deficit in our $226 million two-year budget. If you count in the 5% withhold, we are on budget at the end of October. But we've got a cost coming down the road that we've got to look up. I'll talk about this just briefly. I'm not the expert, but as you know, House Bill 2118, the Quality Metrics Work Group, it's been appointed. They're now meeting. They have a facilitator, so we're looking at bringing the metrics of, you know, Cover Oregon, PEB, OWEB, and the OHA, CCOs, all the metrics, trying to kind of bring them into better alignment. That work group is going, and they're scheduled to complete in May. So that was only 30 seconds after you told me to stop. That's good.
Thank you.
So that's just kind of a quick one.
Representative Whiting, we're going to start with you. Pick out a couple of questions, because then we'll need to move on. Pick out your best one.
If anybody wants to yield questions to me, too, I will take those.
We'll see. I expect probably not. And so, then we'll alternate between the House and the Senate. So if you'll start.
Just real quick, I guess. One of the questions I have, because it looks like we're having to go to paper applications. So, and it's a 19-page application, if I'm understanding this right. And on OPB, I heard Amy was on the radio and said we have one fax machine for taking in these paper applications. Is that true?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wyden, I don't know. I need to. I'm not sure what the communication piece is.
Okay, because if we have one fax machine and people are faxing in 19-page applications, we're in big trouble. So not only is your IT plan failing, now you're paper application things failing. And the other question I have is, one of the things I've been pushed on very hard when we met in my office for hours lots of times, and I enjoyed those conversations, but in the committee and several times, you know, one of the things we were supposed to be presented with was a business plan on how this was going to be carried out, and I've yet to ever see anything come to us. And if this isn't self-sustainable, we're supposed to be closing shop in 2015, which it looks like it's not going to do that. Has the governor talked to you about, hey, maybe we should just cut our losses and go with this point? Or is he going to push ahead and keep throwing dollars at this and wasting money if it doesn't look like it's going to work, just to try and save face?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, first of all, you were, I think, off the committee at this point, but a business plan was presented in February 2012 and approved by the committee and approved by the legislature. So the business plan did go through. In terms of sustainability, we still believe, depending on enrollments, that we're sustainable in 2015 if we can get those enrollments. If we can't, we'll be sitting down with the governor and the legislative leadership, same commitment I made when the legislation was passed, and looking at those options. Now, one option is, and the governor and the legislature, you could choose this, is let's let the feds do it. You know, we can turn this back to the feds. I'm sure not there yet, and I'm not trying to save face, Representative. My face has been battered all through this process, but I still believe we can do this. I think 6 months from now, we're going to go, wow. Too bad this wasn't on board six months ago, but I think we're all going to have, my objective is to have smiles on everybody's faces 6 months from now. We've got a website and a system that works and is serving Oregon citizens.
Thank you.
Senator
Knell. Thank you, Madam Chair. Rocky, by approximate percentage, how much of the website is actually done?
I'm looking for help from my family. Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know if I can say a percent.
Somebody join you?
I don't know if it's fair to say that you know, it's 80% done. One of the things that I will tell you that when I was told very early in the process, in this summer, when I told you, we started looking at the doing the code reviews and having outside people come in and really take a look. I was told it was 80% done. But when I looked at it, only 10% of it was right. So part of this is not the percent done. It's how what the quality is that's really there. I don't know if I can give a percent. How would you introduce yourself?
Sure. Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Cargillo. I'm the Chief Information Officer for Cover Oregon. It would not be easy to talk about the percent completion of the technology. We are basically two releases away from completion, as you saw in the slide that Rocky covered. What we do know is it is down to a number of less than 50 things that we have to get done, and they're not big things to complete this. This is mostly we're finishing our testing cycle so that we can get everything released.
Follow up to that question. So on pages 7 through 11 of the plan, it lists what's done and what's not done. So there's 59 things that you guys indicate are done here, and there's 19 things that are not done. So that's 39 out of 58. So,
Mr. Chair, Revs, or not, the caution there is, in some of those they're yellow. It's two little things that will take one day. In some of those are things that is going to take 5 days. So it's not those are titles. They're not percent of work to be completed. So some of those are very close. For example, the eligibility piece is yellow there, but we're using it. We're using it with our customer service staff. So to say that's not done is not accurate. That's why the yellows. They're in process. And we've identified the critical business functions and the blockers. So the critical business functions are the tracks that are missing. The critical business functions are, you know, the best way to say that is you don't want the train to tip over because the track's not, pounded down in the ground. All those have been identified. They're on a 21-page work plan and release management plan that covers between now and December 16th. And every day, the Oracle staff meet with our business staff and our IT folks, and they review where they are on that plan in order to meet that deadline. So we, and again, as I said, Oracle has flown in beyond their A-team, people that don't work for the CEO of Oracle but work for the founder of Oracle, to ensure that those things are done on time at a quality that will allow us to go live in the month of December.
Any guy?
I have a couple just really technical questions. Medicaid enrollment is not completed, but I thought we had 70,000 that were enrolled now. So is this just certain populations within Medicaid?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, so the 70,000 is separate from Cover Oregon. It's being managed by OHA,
okay.
And so it's not included in those figures.
Okay.
That said, there's a report that we are working on to put out that combine both the OHA and Cover Oregon figures, so you can see both of them lined together and then one combined.
Dr. Golder was going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rocky, I think, you know, there's one issue with the website. Then there's another issue that you alluded to a little bit earlier, which is people's rates going up dramatically, as particularly in the individual market, where they're bumped up to the bronze size plan. And I was curious about one question that you, or a statement that you asserted, where, you know, we all know that Oregon has the most competitive insurance market, but the documents that I'm looking at from the insurance division indicate that there are, for example, 20 states who have lower insurance premiums, including the state of Washington, in the small group markets. This is from the insurance division's 2013 plan. So I was hoping you could tell me the source when you said we're in the lower five or six.
Kaiser Family, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, Kaiser Family Foundation has done a lot of the national research around exchanges and marketplaces and the ratings on those. And one of the things that you have to remember when you look at, and it's important to go to our website. When I brought that, I don't know if we brought it here, we brought it up in an earlier session. We went to the website, and we brought up a bronze level plan for a 55-year-old individual, and it was with the tax credit, $155 for one carrier and $238 for another carrier. So one of the things that consumers have to do, and what the whole purpose of the marketplace is to compare and shop for rates. Don't just accept the rate that you've been offered. It is important to go compare those rates. There are as much as $100 difference between one carrier and another carrier in the rates for the same plans. So I can't speak to general group market. I'm not as smart about the group market, I think, as I would like to be. But in the individual market, there's just great variance, and that's why we're encouraging people to shop.
Could you get me the link to that source where you
the Kaiser
where film? You said we're in the
yep.
bottom five or six?
We can do that. Yep.
So Lively.
Thank you.
And then Connor.
I have many questions, but I'll restrict it to two. Rocky, with all due respect, I have my first concern goes to do with credibility. I attended many of the public functions that you were rolling this out ahead of time. We were talking to people, and up until the day it launched, I was being assured and the people were being assured it was going to work. And I appreciate the two-week soft launch, but at that point, the indications were still that we were on track. And so part of my first question is, so what was the strategy when you started learning as far as notifying the public and letting them know? Because I can tell you a lot of the public, they were confused to start with. They're more confused now, and they have no credibility on whether the system's going to work or not, even if it may. And so I need to understand, so what was the strategy when you were rolling out to get the message out and to correct what was happening?
So I didn't do it very well. And I'll take that. You know, that's on me. And part of that, Representative Wiley, was I don't think I anticipated the kinds of problems that I started seeing in September. We did the best that we could to get the information out, but there was a lot of uncertainty of what we could do and couldn't do. And very frankly, I wasn't sure what to say. But you are correct, and I did not do a good job there. We were running full speed to try to get it done and looking inside rather than outside. And we have a very large hill to climb to get back that credibility. And I can't explain it other than
just one more question. So I appreciate the date now, the December date when this should be. And so in the private sector when I'm doing projects, I always weigh probabilities and understand the risk on both sides. So I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more of the probability of that date and what's the risk on either side of that from the standpoint. If that date doesn't occur, then what happens?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, this was the question that I was fearing that I thought was coming from Representative Greenlick, which came last session, which was give me a percent. What do you wait? I'm assuming it's not going to work. And I'm putting in place all those contingencies I can possibly put in place as if it's not going to work. And I'm doing that because every time there's been a commitment to me that it would work, that hasn't been made. So, long term, I am moving forward. I built those contingencies into my budget. So it's something that I had planned on a year and a half or 2 years ago, and they're there and we'll do that. So when you say then, so what makes you think it will work? I don't have a percentage. What I do have is a man that sat across from me that was sent out by Larry Ellison, who is a founding member or partner of Oracle, who reminded me so much of Steve Jobs, it was uncanny, who looked at me and said, I will get this done. And he is the second or third most senior person to Oracle. He's brought in the talent to do what he can do to make this happen on December 16th. He's also put some very strict requirements on me, meaning Cover Oregon, in that I can't change the goalposts on him. I've told him what I wanted. I can't add to that because he doesn't have time. And that's the kind of project management, very frankly, we needed from day one with those folks and weren't getting. So I'm not putting any money on the ability for them to do it. What I would put money on is the commitment that they've been making to the governor, to us, to congressional delegation to their public embarrassment and their apologies for putting us there. My bet is they will do everything in their power to make it happen, but I can't put a percentage to it. And I'm not going to plan on it happening.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things, Rocky. Business plan without hard numbers isn't a business plan. And when I do a business plan, I have hard numbers. And I am very fearful of what that ultimately is going to look like, looking at what it's costing us to run this puppy now.
Senator, could you pull your mic closer, please? Excuse me.
How about if I just take this little rubber thing out?
Speak up.
Speak up? Okay.
Stop mumbling.
We're a quieter group in the
Senate. More deliberative than Senator Ferriero always said this morning, right?
I missed that one. Okay, just start over. Concerns about the business plan. I mean, we're seeing a business plan from 30,000 feet is what we're seeing. And I have a great deal of concerns about what it looks like when it hits the ground. This is, you know, if you just look at the amount of money we're spending now, and I know a lot of it's for development, but this is an expensive puppy. And so when do you think we're going to have something more realistic in numbers as to what the actual cost is going to be?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the business plan that was adopted by the committees last year included the hard numbers, what our budget was for 2013, 14, 15, 16. It also included member months, total enrollments in all the different various markets, the assessment cost to carriers and state programs, and the enrollments that would be necessary to generate enough revenue to meet those budgets. That said, it's a different world today than it was a year and a half ago. And we are in the process based on, and I will tell you, every state-based exchange is doing the same thing. We are all in the process now of recasting those business plans and those budgets based on what we anticipate as difficulties that every state is having. You know, California, 5 million uninsured, they have 70,000 new enrollments, period. They can't be sustainable on that any more than we can with 30,000 or 50,000. So we are all recasting that. That will be done probably after we get this thing up and running and week, or at least through this first 3 months, so we can see what kind of enrollments that we have. We have a break-even analysis that we've already done for 2015. I know that I need to have in 2015 100,000 enrollments or approximately, and that's, I shouldn't even give that because I'm not sure I can remember. But we've already got a budget for 15. We've got a what we call a break-even analysis for 15. But I will tell you that based on what we see over these next 3 or 4 months, we're all going to be revisiting that. You know, what's Montana going to do with 30 enrollments? You know, even Kentucky, even though they're one of the most successful, does not have a level of enrollment to sustain their exchange in 2015. We're all faced with that same issue.
It puzzled me. We were in San Francisco last week when the president made his announcement, and so I guess the president can decide what part of the law we follow and what part we don't. How long is it going to take the insurance division, or do you know, to restructure? I mean, you know, plans have been canceled and now they're being redone, but the rate case wasn't that made based on the assumption that plans were going to be canceled. It would have had to have been because we all knew that.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I will tell you that Laura Calley, the Insurance Commissioner, has done just unbelievable work over the last 5 days in trying to lay out the details of how the President's option would be implemented, including specific directions to carriers around rates. For example, they've told the carriers that if they were to choose to extend the plans, they would have to maintain the same rates. They couldn't make up those rates in 2015. They would have to come to reserves if there were losses incurred, that what they call the deductibles and I can't remember the technical term for it, but those things, maxim out of pocket cost would have to be rolled over. So there are a lot of restrictions and requirements that have been given instructions to the carriers for them to make, hopefully, a reasonable decision by this Friday in order to have adequate time to notify individuals.
Hey, Rocky, I hate you.
Okay.
Representative Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of things, Rocky. First of all, you keep referring to the fast track Medicaid enrollments and the numbers there. I don't think that's relevant to what's going on with the website and
correct.
For the non-Medicaid population. I just don't think it matters. And so first of all, I want to point out that while that means more people are insured, it has nothing to do with the success or failure of Cover Oregon. You said you'd rather be late and right, and I think we would all agree that we should have been right and on time. Obviously, it's too late for that. This would just kind of be a bad joke about the state's inability to build and deploy large-scale IT projects, except for the fact that it's impacting people's lives. So when you... I'm getting to my question. I'm editorializing a little bit because, like everyone else, I'm really frustrated by this. But I'm not losing my insurance as a result of the failure. When you say that people are being automatically enrolled in a different plan, do you have any idea how much more expensive those plans are?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, yes, I do, to some degree, just like you. We've seen, you know, many of those examples. People, though, have choices. So let me go through those choices. The first choice is if a company elects to extend, they have the choice to stay in their plan at their current rate.
Let's assume they don't.
Okay.
Let's talk about the
then they have the choice then of they will be automatically mapped over or transferred over to the most similar plan, whatever that cost is that they were notified of. Their third choice, in which everybody was encouraged to do, was to go to Cover Oregon's website and take a look at all the plan options and rates. Remember, our rates that we publish on our website, and I could go through and show you if you want to take the time to do that, show all the rates of 11 major carriers for approximately 130 different plans, depending on where you live. So people are being encouraged through the notification process of the carrier to go to Cover Oregon to shop and to look at those plans they may be eligible for or may be eligible for a tax credit or they can buy without a tax credit.
So the answer is no, you don't know how much more the automatic enrollment plans cost on average.
Ms. Chair, Representative Conger, no, because it depends on the age, the plans of every individual.
Okay. Well, anecdotally, I've had people contact me to tell me the premiums are three times as much. And for the population that we're talking about, that's not really an option. It's not a choice. And the paper application process that you're describing, the 19 pages, the one fax machine, let's set that aside. I tried to follow you when you were describing the process to actually get enrolled by a paper application on Cover Oregon, and I couldn't understand the PowerPoint summary, let alone go through the application, get that done in time, not to lose insurance. The problem is that people are going to lose insurance coverage on January 1st. So we throw out all these dates, and really, if you work back from that, so let's take somebody who has an individual policy right now. They can't afford the automatic enrollment, so they reject that. If I understand it correctly, by December 4th, they have to have submitted their 19-page paper application to Cover Oregon. If they don't do that, then they're not going to have coverage on January 1st. Now, down the road, they may be able to enroll as long as open enrollment's available on Cover Oregon, but they're going to lose coverage. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, no, that is not correct. People have the option of enrolling. Forget about Cover Oregon. Close this up. Put us aside. There is a market out there that the majority of the people in this state are going to utilize to enroll in coverage effective January 1, with or without the exchange.
Except the people who can't afford the higher premium. That's the point.
So in that...
And we've got a time problem, and we have other people who want to ask questions. Can we wrap this up?
Can we just keep Rocky for a couple hours?
You can meet Rocky at a bar after the end of the session. We have work to do in addition to this.
I'm going to start repeating people. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Rocky. You indicated that today there's less than 2,000 enrollments. So I heard you say in an earlier presentation today that you originally were projecting 160,000 enrollees by December 31, I think you said, and if you had got 20,000 now, you would be happy. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Culp, no, that was at the end of 2014 that I wanted that many enrollments. The end of 2014, which is two different enrollment years.
So you wanted 20,000 this year, but 160,000 by the end of 14.
End of 14.
Okay.
Is that 20,000 by January 1st?
Of this year.
What? That is correct.
Okay, so I think you were unclear as to what your break-even point is. But if we aren't going to break even on this, which I think is extremely highly likely, are you saying that the legislature is going to need to budget for 2015 X amount of dollars to cover this, or is that going to be borne on the backs of the insurance companies and the people who are ultimately going to pay these premiums?
So, Madam Chair, the break-even applies to 2015. Remember, all operational costs are paid through 2014. Just want to make sure we know that. If we see that we're not in a break-even standpoint because the numbers aren't there, and right now every health insurance exchange is there, then a couple of options that the legislature...
Rocky, wait a minute. You're talking about 100,000 plus... after the three-month enrollment in 2014 and the open enrollment in 2015.
Yeah, I'm talking about by December 31st of 2014.
By January 1st, 2015.
That's correct.
Which takes 3 months of open enrollment in 2014 plus whatever open enrollment there is.
Plus the 6 months we have here.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we understand what those numbers are.
But in answer to your question, the legislature and the governor will have a decision to make, as well as a recommendation from the board, which is, do you put state funds into it, or do you notify the federal government to take it over? That'll be kind of where we are. Or is there something in between that? I'm not prepared at this point to present that option, but I've said that all along, that if it's not sustainable, then a very serious discussion and debate will need to occur as to what people want to do going forward. Those debates and discussions are already starting to occur internally with us as we start to revise and look at the impact of what's happening with the ACA, with some of the decisions that have been made by the federal government.
We've got three more folks' questions here and maybe some follow-up here, but let's start with Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We really do need to be done by at least 15 after.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and co-chair and members. I guess I would rather comment more than ask questions. I guess my fear is that as a state we are operating well beyond our previous legislative policy and appropriation discussion and decisions. I think there are a lot of perplexing questions, but it's complicated because there seems to be a morphing and changing series of policies and costs. Like, for example, right now we're discussing extending what the federal government has determined are substandard policies, raising questions of liability and federal authority and so forth. We have a promise that the 11,000 OMIP, these are the people who have pre-existing conditions, are going to be covered by January 1, but we have a series of broken promises. My local Canby businessman called me rather irate last week. It seems that his policy for his 8 employees is going to double in cost. There will be much higher deductibles and higher co-payments, and family members will be excluded from the policies he now has. Then I hear stories of 400 additional new employees and a comment that we're going to bring whatever resources are needed. I think in Oregon we have quite a tradition of openness and transparency and honesty. And in that regard, I think we need to look at opening this up to a more thorough examination. We ought to have some hearings. And I suspect we are, in order to stay legal, need to have a special session to authorize these changes in both policy and appropriations. And that would be my comment.
Well, we've had three hearings today so far, so...
Go ahead with your next
bill. Who's next? Thompson.
Professor Thompson? Okay,
we've got
Thompson, couple of days.
We've got Thompson and Clem, and then we'll finish.
I realize there's a difference between the federal and the state, but information's come out on how woefully inadequate the federal program is for security. You can breach it with a simple manipulation of the Google search engine, which doesn't give me a lot of confidence. And then you're saying that our program meets the federal security requirements where there apparently aren't any. Without end-to-end testing, what's your level of confidence that our system will be secure once it's completed? Because that's going to be a very big deal publicly.
So, Ms. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'm going to ask Aaron if he can talk about some of the security pieces that are in place or not in place.
State your name.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'm Aaron Cardula, CIO, Cover Oregon. So there has been extensive security testing that is occurring over the last, starting in the beginning of the summer and continuing. And as new code or new parts of the system come in, we test it for security. We have very stringent, the federal government does have very stringent security guidelines and requirements. And to the extent that there's issues with the federal exchange, those issues very likely were that they weren't following, weren't able, something was not in line with those requirements.
So this is really important. The IRS has, you know, come out, sat down with us, looked at the security protocols we've put in place, and just a side story, not related to the IT. So we have a room that that workers do appeals. So if somebody gets a termination they don't like, they can ask for an appeal, and it's just interesting. Those rooms have to have double locks. They can have no drop down ceilings, and they come out and look at this stuff. The IRS has done a pretty thorough job on the security. Protocols that we're required to put in place. That said, there isn't anybody in this room that could sit down here and say nobody's going to get in our place, because it's not happening anyplace. The nice thing about this is that we don't keep a lot of personal information on file. No medical information is on file. It's really just the same information that we now collect as a state on Medicaid, FEOP, and it is less information than is collected today by insurance carriers or OMIP around public health information, for example.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Rocky, I'm an IT guy. It's what my business has been for 15 years. Representative Parker's an IT guy. I get this technological side. You know, I hated it when companies started putting out products and I had to pay money for them, and they're still really needed to stay in beta for like another 7 months. So I actually think you made the right choice to not release. But having said that, you know, my mother-in-law, she got canceled. She's got all Lou Gehrig's disease. She can't talk. You know, she can't get on a computer and look at anything. And in between feeding tubes and my daughter and this job and my wife's job, you know, we're trying to get her covered. Fax machine 5 times we tried yesterday, busy every time. So I don't want anybody calling my office to fix my mother-in-law's problem. I want the system fixed for everybody. I don't want, nobody should come up to me after this and say, hey, let's get her enrolled. We'll go to the fair next Monday. That's fine. So please try. I'm fine switching to an alternative system. I'm an IT guy. This happens. I've had it happen in my own business, and I had to figure out how to make it work. I don't want Oracle making extra money. I want them to eat as much as is reasonable without them dropping the ball, because it doesn't do any good to have them quit right now anyway. But this, we were excited about Cover Oregon because the system before that really sucked. Her insurance company said she was dead. She's not. They canceled her. We couldn't get her back on. We finally used our insurance broker to get her on a policy, and it got canceled. So now I may forget Cover Oregon. Sorry. We may go back to our insurance broker and ask him to do it again for us because he got us on something. The old system sucked. This isn't good yet. I'm hopeful you can fix it, but there's a lot of people like her. We're fine using the fax machine. Just get more faxes. Please keep doing the fairs. We need to get her covered. Everyone else needs to get their family members covered. I won't be angry 6 months from now, but yeah, I'm not really that happy right now. Because in between feeding tubes, I don't really want to explain to her so she can write back on her stencil board what's going on with her insurance.
Okay, guys, I think...
Just one more, and this is from a business, a local business, small business, less than 100 employees, and they said that at some point in time they will no longer be able to be self-insured. Is that true?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Senator Cruz, there is an issue around, and this is not my area, this is insurance division regulation, but in 2016, the markets go, the small group market expands to 100, and that brings in the small group regulations to groups between 50 and 100, and there is a small group regulation that prevents stop-loss coverage from being purchased by a small employer, and I think I'm right here, and the concern is, does that extend to groups 100 in 2016? And I believe that's an issue that's going to be teed up for one of these legislative sessions because it's been brought up.
Yeah.
Again, it's not my expertise, Senator.
Several other people are, too. No, I think that's...
Okay.
Okay. Rocky, the system without Cover Oregon, I feel, is broken. And evidence shows that when a person has insurance, they have better health outcomes. That's a proven fact. And that's why we wanted to go with a system like Cover Oregon. So you've got to fix this website, because I know in the long run that we are going to have lives that are covered and we are going to have better health outcomes in this state.
And I'd like to make a final statement, Rocky. I think we need to have patience, and I do agree that we need to wait to see what things are like 6 months from now and not now. And if it were legal, I would open a book on having 100,000 members on January 1st of 2015. So I have confidence in that, too. As Pete Seeger said in response to the Vietnam War, and this, too, shall pass. Thank you very much for closing the informational hearing. I hope you enjoyed your day today.
Dr. Goldberg?
Good news today, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Mark, have you ever tried to pick a day and tell people a hard day?
We're not moving yet.
I'm staying all night.
You guys, if you're leaving?
All weekend, all night long.
Move out.
Try to get the thing done.
Dr. Goldberg, you have about 10 minutes to 12 minutes.
What I remember Rocky saying all session long was, please don't.
I'm not talking to him. He bailed on us.
We're not going to get these.
And he left us there. He didn't even know we were going to be able to get back.
He said that all session long. Stop adding on.
I have a sense nobody wants to hear you, Dr. Goldberg.
We didn't even know. You took me there. I didn't know how to get back.
I had to take him on BART.
I would think that you'd be capable of finding your own way, Senator Cruz.
Okay, please.
I'm spelling the chaos time there was friendly back.
TV camera's leaving.
Yeah.
Go for it, guys.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority. And with me is Tina Edlund. We'll be brief. We're here today to give you an update on where we are with the coordinated care organizations. I think, as you know, we're now a little over a year into having our first CCOs, which started August a year ago. We've got 16 CCOs up and running. We have approximately 95% of the Oregon health plan population getting their care within a coordinated coordinated care organization. And the reason we're really here today is to report to you on what's about the first 6 to 9 months of good outcome data that we have, how we're doing on cost, and in particular how we're doing on some of the health and quality metrics. We don't have all of them, but we've got the beginnings of our first reasonable amount of data and reasonable report. So I wanted to turn things over to Tina Edlund, who's going to power through this in 9 minutes.
Very quickly. For the record, my name is Tina Edlund. I'm the Chief of Policy for the Oregon Health Authority. What I'd like to do is to start with, I'm assuming you all have copies of the presentation. I'm just going to go through this page by page. As Bruce said, as he pointed out, this is the data. It's early data. Because of that, we don't have data on all of the quality indicators that we're looking at for CCOs and for the state. So it'll become more complete as time goes by and we get further and further down the road on this. So in the second, is it up there?
Yes.
Okay.
Not up there.
That's great. I can just do that. That'll be easier. Okay, I'm going to skip some slides here so that we can get right to the data.
That'll
do it. This will be the easiest way to do it. These are just the focus areas that the quality indicators fall into, so I won't spend any time on those so we can get to the data. At a really high level, the good news is the early findings from this data shows us that every CCO is living within their budget, that the state's meeting its commitment to the federal government to reduce spending trend by 2 percentage points from the 5.4% that the federal government laid out for us. We're showing state-level progress on measures of quality, utilization and cost, and I'll show some of that. I think my caveat to this is that this is early data. We know that progress won't be linear. We'll see this data will attenuate as we get more data in, but we think that what we're seeing right now looks really positive and really encouraging. Just to remind you, we have 33 metrics that the state is held accountable to, and 17 of those the CCOs are held accountable to. If we don't meet our metrics, we're at risk for some significant penalties from the federal government. So it's important that we track it closely and keep our eye on it. I'll skip these slides about what's new in this report, this progress report. This presentation is just a high-level summary of the progress report. All the detail is available out on our website at health.oregon.gov. So the early data shows decreased emergency department visits and expenditures, increased in primary care utilization expenditures, which we always wanted to look at those things together, and that's what we wanted to see is that trend. We wanted to see the reduction in emergency department visits. Increased enrollment in patient-centered primary care homes, decreased hospitalization for conditions that if they're treated well in a primary care setting, you see fewer hospitalizations for them. Congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and adult asthma are the three that we have right at this point in time. Increased adoption of electronic health records and decreased hospital readmissions, which is a cost driver in the hospital setting. So this is the actual data. Enrollment in patient-centered primary care homes. Patient-centered primary care homes are at the center of what we're doing with coordinated care organizations, and it's one of the metrics that the coordinated care organizations are held accountable for. That has increased from the baseline. It's a 2012 baseline. It's increased from 52% to 71% enrollment in primary care homes, which is really, it's pretty significant in a non-statistical way in that you consider that the program itself just started in 2012 and we only have a year of CCOs. Emergency department utilization is down. The first 6 months show that it's down 9% from the baseline in 2011.
That's pretty good.
Costs for emergency department utilization. We had the utilization down 9%. Costs, the PMPM costs, are down 18% from 2011. CCO primary care visits are up 18%. Again, that's what we wanted to see. That's exactly the direction we wanted to see. Primary care costs are up 6.5% from the 2011 baseline. And all-cause readmissions are down by 12%, which is, you know, in this state we have a fairly low readmission rate anyway, so this is also really encouraging news. Admissions for these chronic conditions are all down. I didn't include the math here, but it's anywhere from 20-25% for these three conditions. Again, my caveat there, I have some caveats at the end of this. My caveat there is that this is only a half year of data. To the extent that there are some winter months not included in this data, we would expect those to change a bit. But again, the direction is really encouraging right now. Adoption of electronic health records. The way we looked at this is we looked at the number of providers who are claiming incentive payments through the federal government's program. That has changed from the 2011 baseline. 28% were claiming incentive payments for the use of electronic health records, and 57% are claiming those payments in 2013. So again, that's something that we wanted to see. We wanted to see that kind of connectivity and exchange of information in the state. This is a piece that's really been important to us, is getting race and ethnicity data and looking at disparities in the state. This report is the first time we've been able to look at, we have the baseline data in this report. You begin to be able to see what disparities, where we have disparities for these metrics in the state, and where there might be opportunity for culturally appropriate focused intervention. Again, I have the caveats. I won't talk about this too much. We have, for example, you'll see when you go out and look at the actual quarterly report that the rates for adolescent well care visits are very, very low, but this data is all from January to June. Most of these visits happen during the summer, so we don't capture that time period. So just a caveat not to overinterpret the data, as encouraging as it is. The other issues are there's claims lag. A lot of this data comes from billing claims data. There's claims lag, and we don't have all that in. It takes a while for it to come in. The seasonality issue I just talked about. And there's some startup impacts. I mean, the CCOs have been very, very busy getting started up, and obviously have been very busy working with their providers to move the needle on these on coordinated care. So the next steps are we'll continue to aggregate and produce this data. We're continuing to collect it. We'll continue to report every quarter and roll it up as we go along. All of this will be reported at the CCO level as we get more data. Right now it's just state-level data, but the next report will start to show CCO-level data. The data will become more and more complete as we go along. So it's health.oregon.gov, and that's where you can go find it. It's actually right on the front page there when you go out there. So thank you. I can take questions.
Bruce, do you have other things to present?
A question, Mr. Chair?
Widener. Rep. Widener.
Did you say Widener or Lively?
Yeah. Widener.
Widener, you got it.
I can just hand it over to Lively if you'd rather.
I didn't hear.
Just real quick, you said enrollments were up and everything, but we didn't have a number. I'm just wondering how we're doing, because we're supposed to be roughly about 733,000 people by 2013 to 15 in that time period. Are we hitting those benchmarks that there'll be that many people enrolled in the CCO program?
Co-chairs, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, I don't have our exact number in Medicaid, but I do look at our caseload forecast every month. I looked at it. We just had our most recent caseload forecast, and our caseload forecasts are tracking about exactly as to where we were. We were somewhere in the high 600,000s in our Medicaid program today, and we're estimated to be somewhere in the well above that in 13-15.
Then if I may follow up, the other thing would be cost per patient, because we were about $10,142 a patient, with the increased cost going up to about $12,244, but we're supposed to reduce it to where we end up back down at about the $10,000 range. Does it look like we're going to hit those numbers as well?
Co-chairs, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, right now our per member per month, our per capita costs are capped at going up 4.4% this past year and 3.4% the next year. Our CCOs within their global budgets are meeting those targets today. I don't have the dollar figure of what that is, but can get you that. But the cost increase trajectory is holding at where we had hoped it would be.
We're about 10.5 to 11,000 of patients, then, sounds like. I'm just rough math. You can get it to me later.
I will get you the exact dollar figure.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce Rutino, what assurances can you give us that this data is actually correct? Is this does this come from the All Payer All Claims database? Help us feel better or good about the integrity of the data.
Senator Shields, the data comes from, it's the claims billing data that is submitted by the CCOs to the state. It's the same data that then gets submitted to the All Payer All Claims database, but it comes to us first and then gets submitted there. We use the data feed that comes into us from the CCOs. What we do is every single month, besides the regular vetting and cleaning process that the claims data goes through when it comes into us, every month what we're doing is we're sending back out to the CCOs what we're seeing in these numbers, what we're seeing in this as we run these algorithms for these metrics, and literally problem solving at the patient level. They will call us and say, you know, we're not, you're only seeing 10 patients in this category and we're seeing 12, and we actually problem solve that to make sure that the data is right, because we understand how important it is, and it's the kind of test and validation that the federal government will be doing for us as well.
And I could follow up, because one thing I'm concerned about, and we've heard testimony previously about emergency department utilization and what we can do about it, and I think in North and Northeast Portland I saw some data that it's off the charts ED utilization compared to the population. So I'm very interested in seeing how that breaks down by a particular CCO. Look forward to seeing that in the next iteration.
Right, we'll have that in the next report. Thank you.
So I've been asked to ask you a question.
Sure.
My understanding is that none of the CCOs have created contracts with alternative care providers like chiropractors and naturopaths. Is that, can you confirm whether that's true or not? And if it is true, is there some intention to do something about it?
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, I do know that several of our CCOs have their members see naturopaths, chiropractors. There's a number of multi-specialty clinics that they contract with where naturopaths, acupuncturists, allopathic docs all work together, and our CCOs work with them. We have, as I think many people know, particularly Rep. Thompson, we worked hard on a process whereby CCOs are, within the legislation, cannot discriminate against a class of provider. We have a process whereby if a provider does feel that they're being discriminated against, that they can bring that to us and we'll take a look at it. We have a rules process in place. I haven't checked the last several months, but about 3-4 months ago, there had only been one complaint about that. And the last thing that we've done is I've brought together actually a multidisciplinary group of some chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists, I think massage therapists, and some of the medical directors from the CCOs and some allopathic doctors to come together and start to advise us about the kinds of policies we need to have a more inclusive and integrative approach. So that's how we're handling things today.
Has the group met?
Yes, I believe it has.
Steiner Hayward, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I may. The first is, there have been some challenges around helping make sure that people stay assigned to the primary care provider they were already seeing. Where do we stand with that at this point?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner, members of the committee. We're two things. One, in the process we have right now in enrollment, and you heard a little bit about the fast track. One of the things that we've done, we've added one very important question to that fast track form, and that question is, who is your primary care provider? And we did that explicitly so that we can proactively now, as people come onto the health plan, look to get them enrolled, let the CCOs know who their primary care provider is, be certain that that provider is hopefully contracted with that CCO and maintain continuity. And as we move forward, we're going to look to make certain that as we enroll people more and more, that's going to be one of the questions so that we don't have people assigned where they not knowing who their primary care provider is.
Thank you. And a follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. The piece of that, then, that ties in with the other concern I had is this. You know, you mentioned that you sent out 200 and something thousand.
40,000.
Mm-hmm. 240,000.
240, thank you. Suddenly had a math problem there. Yeah. 240,000 letters to individuals or families?
I believe it was individuals.
Thank mm-hmm. you. And you've gotten 70,000 of those individuals back signed.
Correct.
Signed up. What's the plan for reaching that additional 170,000? Don't get me wrong. 70 is fabulous. I'm thrilled. It's a great thing you're doing, but I'd like to know what the next step is.
Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, we just this past couple of days sent out an additional 140,000 letters. We sent out 240. We got about 70, 80, we got a little bit more back. Some of those people ended up not qualifying. But we know who everyone that came back is. And now what we do is we have the list of the remaining people. And we sent out about 140,000 letters over the last 3 days to the remaining people. And there's another 30,000 going out at the end of the week that are letters that go to 10 different languages, people whose primary language is in English. Yeah. The 140 that went out were in English. Mm-hmm. Another 30 will go out in 10 different languages. So we've got another bolus going out, and we expect that that will bring in another group of individuals.
Great. I'd like to thank OHA for helping support the Postal Service in all of this as well.
it's been quite an effort.
Yeah. A comment and a question. I'll follow up with you later on this, but I think we have work to do on that chiropractic, naturopathic sure. thing. I'm being told, as a matter of fact, that there's a place on the Cover Oregon website that says naturopathic services are not covered, which would indicate we don't need very many naturopaths if we advertise that. You know, yeah. But there may be a disconnect somewhere. Playing devil's advocate, which I seldom do, as you know, I have a question. I'd like to see some follow-up down the line on some of these numbers. For adult asthma and COPD.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the Senate needs to recess and because we have another rest of agenda that we're going to carry on over in Hearing Room E. So if you don't mind, we're going to just sneak out and go next door to finish our agenda.
It's really good having a joint meeting, and I hope we can continue this.
Okay, so we are in the Senate is in recess.
For one of your rooms.
Mitch, I forgot, but I'll remember next time.
Oh, that's right, the blue one, yeah.
Too many things to carry.
Okay. For using your numbers for adult asthma and COPD, which are down, yes. I think that's great.
Thank you.
But I'm a little questioning of those numbers because those are very difficult disease states. What I want to know is, are they down because we have proactively done something other than providing just primary care access? We had to do something to correct the disease. get it down? Or are they down because, for lack of better wording, the CCOs put out the word to their network that if you put any of these people in the hospital, we'll kill you, in which case it's denial of access or denial of care. And those two, either way, or a balance of the two, you know, I need some assurance that when these numbers go down, it's because we provided really good medical care that we were not providing before and caused the numbers to go down, rather than we mandated the numbers to go down. I can make the numbers go down if I just tell you, I'll throw you out of the network if you put anybody in the hospital. That'll make the numbers go down. But these are difficult, stubborn disease states that I don't think we've had enough time to make them go down by good medical practice.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick,
I know you don't have the answer, but just watch that.
We will. And Chair Greenlick, Rep. Thompson, members of the committee, it's a great question. And it, you know, this dates back to when we started to put together the CCOs, because I think one of the issues about the global budget and the cost targets was, you're absolutely right, one of the easiest ways to meet your cost target is to deny care. And so therefore, we very specifically put in place a variety of quality metrics to be certain that care wasn't being denied. Digging down a little further, you know, what we do know is that many of the CCOs have been, first of all, focusing on individuals with chronic illness. Mm-hmm. They all have plans about how they're going to improve the health of their population. When you look at the results, they are good. One, we believe that they'll bounce around a bit. So this is just a first look. But they made sense to us based on the fact that there have been real investments in chronic illness, real investments in better primary care to keep people out of the hospital and keep them well. And so these have been real focuses of the CCOs. It fits. The data fits with what we're seeing on the ground.
Okay. Let's see what happens in the winter.
Exactly.
Is that a conger? This will be the last question, then we'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just give us a quick description of what we're going to do about the high-risk OMIP population, the pre-existing conditions?
Happy to. Chair Greenlick, Rep. Congress, members of the committee, we have a little over 10,000 individuals on OMIP. We have been letting them know preceding October 1 that OMIP was phasing out and they would need to find other insurance. We have now made a series of robocalls to OMIP recipients. We have sent every OMIP recipient a paper application. Those went out a couple of weeks ago. Clear instructions. In order to maintain coverage, you need to fill out this application, get it back by November 25th was the deadline we gave OMIP. We wanted to create some sense of urgency and let people know that the website was not a place to enroll. They needed to enroll by paper. We've worked with community partners that have been calling each and every OMIP recipient personally and again informing them, and two, getting some information as to who will be coming onto the exchange. A fair number of people in OMIP may likely choose to just go to the non-exchange market because they don't qualify for a tax credit, so they can sign up directly with an insurer.
Some are going to the health plan.
Some, right. We have already fast-tracked those individuals who are on OMIP, who also will come into the fast track. And now, as applications come back, they've been specifically marked so that we can, as applications come in from these 10,000 individuals, we will know who submitted an application. We will be able to, much like with the fast track letter, be able to, over the next several weeks, go back out and remind those who we haven't gotten applications from that they need to. So we've been very aggressive on the front end, lots of calls, sending an application packet and instructions. We'll be tracking them as they come back in, working with community partners, and we hope that through all of that, we will be able to certainly maintain coverage for people as they see fit.
So may I briefly follow up, because I didn't understand part of what you said. I mean, first of all, it's November 20th. If the deadline was November 25th and you don't know how many are coming back, then either you're going to get them all at the last minute or people aren't responding, which I understand you're doing outreach, and I get the problem there. But I didn't understand when you said that people might go and buy insurance on the market. I thought the reason we had OMIP was because they had pre-existing conditions and they couldn't just go onto the market and buy an individual plan.
Rep. Conger, you're correct. Previously, people were being underwritten out. Now, January 1, they're no longer, they can't be denied coverage. So anybody, regardless of their underlying medical condition, can go and buy an insurance policy. They can't be denied because of illness. That's why we had OMIP. The point,
the downsides of Obamacare.
Right,
I think you've answered the question.
The point I was making, however, was that for individuals above 400% of poverty, they won't qualify for a tax credit. Therefore, those individuals can go directly to an insurance company and buy a policy rather than coming through the insurance exchange. So we believe that there are a number of current OMIP recipients, particularly those above 400% of poverty, who won't fill out the application to come through the exchange because they're not going to get a tax credit, and they can just go onto the individual market that exists outside of the exchange, sign up with an insurer, if that made sense.
It doesn't, but I'll follow up with you later.
Okay.
And I thought that was why there was the exchange, was to pool people together. I don't see how you would have a pool of people in an individual market outside of the exchange that an insurer could underwrite. So maybe we'll try to follow up on that after.
Happy to.
Thanks, Bruce.
Okay. Oh, have you notified that high-risk HIV population in the same way?
Yes. We've been working with the, you're talking about the program that individuals with HIV get their drug coverage through buying a OMIP policy, yes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing. Move on to the agenda. We're going to have to compress items. Mr. Burns, will you join us for a very brief report? I know some of us are very anxious to hear how things are going in that program. But 5 minutes, maybe?
Two
minutes. You guys want to move over on this side if you want to.
I want to get over here.
We have no adult supervision now, so we can do whatever we want. Tom, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. In that capacity, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, I do the policy for that program. You've asked me to comment upon the implementation of Senate Bill 470, which this committee passed last year. The bill passed. It goes into effect on January 1st. We have done all the data processing. We've written all the rules. We have tested all the systems. We are all set to go on January 1st for the following things. Allow a practitioner to delegate staff in their office to access the system. That was one of the things we heard from the doctors, saying the system was cumbersome and we needed a better way to not use doctors' time to have to access it. Allow practitioners who have Oregon, who live, try that one again, allow practitioners in Washington, Idaho, and California who have Oregon residents as their patients to look at the system. They will sign up just the same way as any practitioner here in Oregon does. We have got agreements with the medical boards for those three states so that we can go and verify that, in fact, that Dr. Tom, who is from Vancouver, is, in fact, licensed in Washington and meets the same requirements that Dr. Tom would meet if he lived and practiced in Oregon. We've expanded the data collection points to address the issues of the number of days and the number of refills. That was one of the concerns that the prescribers had, is they didn't know, you know, if you prescribed 100 tablets of OxyContin, was that a 30-day supply or a 90-day supply, and that we'll now have that data. We'll be able to search on the DEA license. A number of prescribers wanted to know whether somebody was using their DEA license for illegal prescribing. They can ask for that. We give that information to them. What they do with it is their business. We are not in the law enforcement, and we won't go out and try and chase these guys down. And we allow the state medical examiner access to the data for the purposes of conducting autopsies. One issue that was not approved in this committee and you asked us to work on, and that was the issue of establishing push notices. If the data showed that a certain individual had received, for example, 5 prescriptions over the course of 5 weeks from 5 different doctors, that perhaps something is going on with that patient, that the doctors may not be communicating with each other, we can see the data, and so we had proposed that we have the authority to push a notice out to those 5 prescribers and say, you might want to look at Tom and figure out what's going on with Tom. You did not give us that authority. You asked us to work with the ACLU on that. We have met with the ACLU. We haven't reached an agreement on sort of how to put a box around that idea. Is it 4 out of 4? Is it 5 out of 5? You know, those types of things. What exactly is the box that we would use for this? And so it would require legislative approval. We had talked about potentially doing that in the February session. We do not have language. We do not have a proposal. And we will not be back here in February for any changes to this program.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions? Thank you very much for your report.
I hope it was 2 minutes.
It was excellent. Close that. Informational hearing. We get a presentation on the use of anesthetist assistance in Oregon. We had scheduled 20 minutes. I hope you'll take 15.
I think we'll work on it. We should have a PowerPoint coming up.
I just received it, so it's not been loaded.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't give it to us.
Okay.
Just now.
We will
talk.
Improvise.
There you go.
My name is Greg Miller, here today representing the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists to talk about anesthesiologist assistance with you. This is a license and a profession that is currently active in 16 states and has been so for over 30 years, but it is not recognized as a licensed profession in the state of Oregon. I would like to talk to you about that in the context of what it would take to license a profession and what exactly anesthesiologist assistant is as it relates to healthcare and assisting with an anesthesiologist in surgery. Not unlike how a physician's assistant is used either in a surgical setting to assist the surgeon, in the clinical setting assisting a physician or another medical specialties, the anesthesiologist assistant is there as a physician extender for an anesthesiologist and is acutely active and direct in administering medications during surgical procedures that the anesthesiologist is directly involved in. So without going a little bit any further, I would defer to the experts here who are here to talk about the profession for you, and hopefully they can answer some of the questions you have and shed some light on the license and what the profession means in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlake and committee members, for allowing us to speak on this topic. My name is Claire Chandler. I am an anesthesiologist assistant practicing in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm also the immediate past president of our National Association for Anesthesiologist Assistants, and I also sit on the board that accredits AA education programs. Our PowerPoint was a brief summary of the practice, the education, and some of the details that we wanted to bring to light today. So anesthesiologist assistants are defined by the Code of Federal Regulations as non-physician anesthesia providers. It's the same way that the CFR defines nurse anesthetists. We work strictly within a care team model, not independently, and specifically under the medical direction of an anesthesiologist. Not any physician, but specifically an anesthesiologist. It's a graduate degree. There are 10 programs right now, and we are producing just over 200 graduate AAs a year. We practice in 16 states currently. via state statute or a few states via delegatory authority. We have the programs, the education programs are accredited by the Commission on Accreditation for Allied Health Education Programs, and that body is accredits over 19 other allied health professions, including EMTs, surgical technologists and technicians, medical assistants, and some other not allied health professions. So that's the body that accredits the AA programs. The AA programs are 24 to 28 months in length. In order to be accepted into an AA program, you need certain prerequisites very similar to what you would need to enter a general PA program or even medical school. So advanced biology, chemistry, mathematics, all the pre-medical core requisites are required to enter into an AA education program. And also the MCAT and or GRE are required for admission. During the course of that educational experience, students receive over 600 didactic hours of classroom work and receive over 2,000 hours or 2,600 hours now of clinical experience. And also every education AA education program now is incorporating simulation into their education model. So upon graduation to practice, AAs must pass a certification exam that is administered by the National Commission for the Certification of Anesthesiologist Assistants. And every 2 years, we must receive 40 continuing medical education credits, and every 6 years, successfully complete recertification examination. We are regulated by the state boards of medicine, and currently there are just over 2,000 AAs practicing in the country. So AAs, our scope of practice, we're limited to the duties and responsibilities that are delegated to us by the anesthesiologist in the role of the care team. In consultation with the anesthesiologist, we take appropriate actions intraoperatively and perioperatively to counter problems that may develop while implementing the care plan that's collectively agreed upon. So just for example, my interaction with you, if you were to have surgery, I might start your IV. I might do your preoperative health assessment. And I would... in the OR with the anesthesiologist who is administering the medication that puts you to sleep, I could place the breathing tube, possibly an invasive monitor in your wrist that would watch your blood pressure, and various techniques that are necessary within the OR. Other delegated duties. Basically, we function within a care team model in the same role as a nurse, anesthetist extender would when they're working within a care team model. So our responsibilities are the same. Advantages?
I'm sorry, did you say your responsibilities are the same as a nurse anesthetist?
Within the care team model. So when both of those individuals are working under the direction of an anesthesiologist, we can perform similar duties. And, for example, at my institution at Emory, I would break a nurse anesthetist. They would come in and give me a lunch break. I would take over their case at the end of the day. So, yes, we are interchangeable within the care team. So as the population of anesthesiologists grows older, it's not being replaced at a sustainable level. I think many of the things we see in healthcare are the expansion of the need for anesthesia services throughout the healthcare environment. With the Affordable Care Act, an aging population, and we're obviously seeing an increase in demand as well for anesthesia services, and we need more providers. AAs work in both inpatient and outpatient settings, and we do the cases with all the levels of acuity within the care team model. So we'll do cardiac cases, neurosurgical cases, anesthesia for neurosurgical cases, transplant cases, pediatric cases. We are trained to do all the subspecialties that fall within anesthesia services. and we both work in urban and rural settings within the care team across all surgical specialties.
Chairman Greenlee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Dr. Frank Pomrose. I'm a past president of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists and a staff anesthesiologist working at Providence St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland. We're here today to request that anesthesiology assistants be licensed in the state, and there's reasons for that. We're in a sea of great change in healthcare, in how it's delivered, how it'll be compensated, and who will be the ultimate caregivers. We have the triple aim as our target, but in the past, when the world was unknown to people, when the cartographers had to draw up everything, they had to draw in lines where they did not know they were. And it was only through research and exploration that we found the truth and the map was correctly given. The future for our healthcare is going to be similar to that. We're going into the unknown, and we're going to have to make things up and do things different than what we have done in the past. Prepare, we will need all available options. This will involve the use of more allied healthcare providers. In anesthesia, we will need more manpower and more efficient use of resources. Anesthesiologist assistants are a necessary step to fill our workforce needs in this future. The anesthesia care team models using anesthesiologist assistants supervised by anesthesiologists is one of those options. Anesthesiologist assistants are highly trained in academic anesthesia programs and are licensed in many states, employed in anesthesia care team models, and providing care for hundreds of patients daily. They are certified by national boards closely allied with our national boards and with the American Society of Anesthesiologists for both their education programs and their certification programs. And such anesthesiologist assistants and anesthesiologists are on these same committees working together to provide the future. The care team model has been shown to be a much safer model than the non-care team model as well. The American Society of Anesthesiologists is a program now called When Seconds Count, and that's shown that in a situation there was a dire emergency, the care team model with the anesthesiologist involved, you have a better outcome of surviving emergent care in the operative room. My professional organization and others around the state are pushing for the practice of these individuals in our state. But there's also other reasons as well. There's a more personal reason. We know of at least one student who is an Oregonian who is in the anesthesiologist assistant training program currently. And there are other members who are from the Northwest as well. I've been born and raised in the state, and I always plan to come back and practice in the state, and I believe that we should offer this to our children and our sisters and our brothers as well. Thank you.
Are there questions?
Just a quick question. What's the difference in training duration and average starting salary for nurse anesthesiologists and AAs?
So I can give you some information about the AA profession specifically. When within the care team model and when the scope of practice is similar, the pay rate is similar. So AAs, graduating AAs, depending on where you're working, are starting anywhere from $80,000 up, and that obviously goes up with level of experience. So that is very similar, side by side with the CRNAs that I work with. Every individual that starts at the same level for that.
And training time is the same?
No.
I'm not exactly sure how long their training programs are, do you know?
It varies. I think it's a little bit longer. I think the clinical hours are 26, and I cannot recall exactly, but I think it was a little bit more than some of the CRNA training hours.
Yeah. And it's my understanding that the physician groups are supporting this, the OMA and your anesthesiologists.
Well, not the OMA, the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists.
The OMA hasn't taken a position.
Oh, they have not taken a pro stand on it. They did support our Bill 630 in the last legislature, but this mainly applies to anesthesiologists because an anesthesiologist assistant can only be directed by an anesthesiologist. It cannot be provided by any other surgeon or anyone else. So it cannot be used in a care team model where the surgeon may be supervising the anesthesia provider.
And I think it's important to note also that because AAs are trained by anesthesiologists and alongside residents, that medical model is ingrained in our culture of our profession, and so it's easy to understand what role we are playing within that anesthesia care team for the anesthesiologist and the AAs alike.
Sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before I close, I do want to note we have We have testimony offered by the Oregon Association of a Nurse Anesthetist who aren't quite as enthusiastic. But it is in the record. You can find it on our list. We'll close the informational hearing. Thank you, particularly you for coming from so far away.
My favorite thing.
We appreciate that. I'm going to open a public hearing on the report from the Task Force on Individual Responsibility. Representative Conger, are you introducing that, or?
I am not.
Okay.
No.
We have.
I was on that one.
You were on that one.
And so
you guys were on
that. We were on that.
Compadres.
Are you,
I'm just asking why Conger wasn't on that one.
Are you starting this or somebody else? What's the plan?
You want to say something? Well, I'll just say that I had the great pleasure of being on this with Representative Jim Thompson, and we also had Senator Boquist and Senator Bessie Johnson were on the committee. And ably staffed by Oregon Health Authority, Chris DeMars, and her team. So, fabulous team. Melinda was a great chair. Can't wait. It was a lot of work in a very short amount of time. A great presentation report that's in your materials. And I'll turn it over to you, because you did a great job of chairing this committee.
Thank you.
Go for it.
All right. Do we have the clicker?
Let me go ahead and start.
Page down.
It's page down? Okay. Why don't I go ahead and start in the meantime,
please.
Since I want to be very brief, because I know you guys are a little behind. I'm Melinda Muller. I'm a physician from Legacy Health in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a primary care physician. And Kay Dickerson, who just arrived, she was one of our members of the commission of the task force as well. So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the overview because I'm going to talk about it anyways. We did have 11 members, including the bipartisan representation as noted. We also had two members of the Oregon Health Plan. We had a health navigator, four healthcare professionals, and we did have representation from both urban and rural to try to get a fully kind of broad brush. As a reminder, this was established by House Bill 2859 and was meant to help figure out how to establish mechanisms to help more engage our members. We worked very hard in those four sessions, as Representative Kenny Geyer said, and we did complete our work and submit recommendations by November 1st. Here's the timeline, just to say that we had four meetings in September and October, and it was a rush, but we got everything done, and here I am presenting. We had several invited presenters, both from the Oregon Health Authority as well as other experts in the field, to give us a background of where we've been so far, both with the Oregon Health Plan, health system transformation, and where we are in the current initiatives. As part of that, we did look at what the guidelines were and what options there were, both from federal and state policy. We also spent a lot of time reviewing the evidence on what does engage members, with specific focus on Medicaid members and specific focus on the roles that disincentives and incentives play, and really trying to see what does the evidence say as opposed to what do people think. So recommendations is specifically around, it's not achieved solely through that. We really put a lot of time on financial incentives and what works and what doesn't work. Really came to the, based on the evidence, that if you want simple behavior change, financial incentives can work. But if you want complex behavior change, where you want people to really do something differently, you need a more comprehensive approach. We wanted to work within the framework that had already been created through the CCOs and not put more requirements on the CCOs, who are still trying to figure out what they're doing already. And we really wanted to leverage the Transformation Center to provide the support for those CCOs in their work. So as far as cost sharing goes, we did look at a variety of incentives, looked at a variety of what we could do from both an incentive and disincentive standpoint, and found really limited evidence of the efficacy and cost effectiveness of using incentives and disincentives in Medicaid programs. And you'll see the evidence in your packet. There's an extensive list of what the evidence did show. We did show that we did find, though, that if you look at cost restructuring the cost sharing, that may be helpful. And so our first recommendation was specifically around
obtaining federal approval to allow us to restructure the benefit program so that we can look at value-based benefit design, incenting things we know work, disincentive things that we know aren't good for people, i.e. ED visits, and to help push the benefit design along. That would require expansion of our existing waiver. The next set of recommendations are specifically around providing resources and support, and we wanted to task the Transformation Center to really help provide information to the CCOs so they don't have to find all this on their own. That there is a lot of evidence out there, and can we have the Transformation Center help put all that into a packet to help the CCOs implement it. And also with the transformation plans that all the CCOs are actually working on right now, can they incorporate this information in a way to help them push it out to the end? And then the third was using the Choosing Wisely campaign. There is some information in your packet about that as well, which is a national effort that really looks at value-based design as well as what works and what doesn't and what does the evidence show so that we can be incenting and paying for the right care. The second, continuing on that, the other piece was we really want to look at how can we engage the members early on with health appraisals. We don't want to call them health risk assessments specifically, but how can we figure out what do people need early on in the process so that we then can structure the benefits for what they need. And also look at, as we try to incorporate other traditional health workers in the care, how can we look at what the barriers CCOs may or may not be having to help them do that more effectively. Another recommendation was around fostering the strategies. Again, really, how do we work with the traditional health workers that may be in the CCOs, may be in community settings and community-based organizations? Rural and urban may have different needs and may have a different set of workers, and so how do we help support those? Also, can we work with the professional licensing boards to help with this engagement idea to get some of that information out so that people want to do CME as part of that and part of getting their licenses renewed? It's an option. They don't have to, but it's an option, as well as how do we connect what this work and engagement with other initiatives in the state, specifically around health information technology. And there's that's all in your packet. Kay, did you want to add anything? Are you okay?
No, I was walking, looking fine.
So I'd entertain any questions if you have any.
You have a giant kind of comment.
Pardon me?
Actually, you're done with your presentation.
I think I'm done with the presentation, unless okay. The two representatives who are on the committee wanted to say anything.
Is there going to be a bill or anything that's going to have to come from this? Or
no, I believe so. I think we can handle it all administratively. It's a fairly simple. Well,
and a lot of the work was directing Oregon Health Authority Health Transformation on what to do, and that was within their capacity.
Is it legal to do something simple and straightforward?
We spent some time trying to figure out how to
perhaps make it. Perhaps we could make it not legal.
We wanted to complicate it. We really did.
Thompson
told us it would not be a wise decision.
Right. At the end of the day, we decided to keep it simple.
I just want to say one thing that I went to the bill signing earlier today for the Traditional Healthcare Workers Commission.
Oh, great.
And that was a big piece of this, is that those are the folks, the certified but unlicensed folks that are actually in the community interacting, where we want a lot of that behavior real change to take place. So I think these two things moving forward together is very exciting to me.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a bit about the evidence base. How strong? I mean, this is a field that has had a lot of nonsense published about it. I mean, how strong do you? I mean, how clear are we going to be to try and stick to the evidence base about what really works?
We spent probably 4+ hours of those meetings just hearing the evidence and hearing from Dr. Butterworth, who really said the evidence, there's very specific evidence on very specific things. So, for example, you could get a pregnant woman to stop smoking for the duration of her pregnancy by offering a gift card. Right, and because there's an incentive, she has an internal incentive, and then there's another incentive.
I can tell you that the hardest project I ever did in my whole life was trying to get pregnant women to quit smoking.
Yeah. So
because what happened was, the pregnant women who figured out that they shouldn't be smoking quit before the first prenatal visit.
Exactly.
The others didn't want to talk to you about it because they said, my problem is not smoking, my problem is being pregnant. And it was a nightmare. I guarantee you I could have handed them $150 worth of credit with a gift cards, and they would not have quit smoking.
There were a couple studies that show it was effective, but what most of the studies showed is that the data is not very good. It can be done in very isolated situations for very distinct reasons, and you could have some effect. But when you're talking about complex behavior change, going to a primary care clinic as opposed to going to the ER for everything, it takes a village of tools to convert that. So all the evidence we reviewed is in your packet, and some of it's pretty good. There's not a lot of great evidence, especially within Medicaid. A lot of the evidence is within the commercial health plan realm.
All right. If there are no other questions, well, thank you very much.
I think one of the important things that we came out of this was we realized that sending a whole lot of stuff out and telling the CCOs to get on the stick and report back to us was not going to be effective. So we took the route of asking the health authority to sift through things that seemed to work and disseminate that information, suggesting the CCOs might want to try this and be more proactive rather than ask each CCO to do some kind of a crazy study they don't have time to do.
We might want to ask the Health Evidence Review Commission to take a look at some of these things as well.
And was there, I'm sorry, I don't have the bill in front of me. Was there a mechanism for follow-up once these recommendations were developed from the group? Is there an expectation of follow-up?
Of a report back at least to the...
Yeah, or just to see, you know, do we want to hear from OHA on how it's being implemented? Or
where are they going? Are they going to OHA, the recommendation?
Yes. Health transformation.
Yeah.
And because we did want in everybody's transformation plan to at least... have something in the transformation plans around this that also will help hold the CCOs accountable that they're paying attention to this.
Well, let's put this on the agenda for them to report back on how it's going as part of the transformation. Thank you very much for your work on this.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You guys, too. It's just amazing to actually ask somebody to do something and get a report back.
Record time. We didn't take 9 months.
Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the hearing on individual responsibility and health engagement, and open a hearing on an informational hearing on the durable medical equipment reuse program. You guys starting that?
I'll just start it from here. Do we have the first several people coming up? Is David Kamerji here?
Joey Rizzano.
Is David here? David Committee?
Yes.
So David, we wanted you to start it off.
Okay.
Come on up. So I'll just say that as David's getting his things organized, I'll say that this is a fabulous, passionate constituent of mine, physical therapist, working particularly with children and very motivated to take care of their needs better. And so this work group was a result of a bill that he initiated and I sponsored during the last session. And we had 4 meetings over October and November to get us to this place. And I want to especially thank Roberto Gutierrez, who I think just stepped out, my LA right there. I was thanking Roberto for all the staffing of this. It's a very informal work group, and so we kind of took on the staffing ourselves, and Roberto did all the logistics and contacting people, and it kind of grew each time with a lot of excitement about the idea. So I'd love to turn it over to David and then maybe say a word at the end.
Thank you. For the record, I am David Komeji.
David.
Chairman Greenlick, Vice Chairs, Kenny Geyer, Thompson, and the rest of the board. I also work in Estacada.
Ah, my area. Thank you.
I currently work in Estacada, so I'm all on there. I'm a physical therapist who, with the help of this,
bipartisan link. It's a bipartisan link.
There's always a bipartisan link somehow.
Well, Thompson was on this.
That's right. Representative Thompson was also was part of this work group. With the help of this committee, we were able to convene a legislative work group to solicit feedback and provide input on the last legislative session's House Bill 2137, which is to repurpose durable medical equipment. And just a brief concept of where we were, and I'm going to kind of condense this, is I worked for the school districts for 18 years in Portland Public Schools and Columbia Regional Programs, where we actually, through an unfunded mandate, had to provide equipment to children for their educational access. And since there was no money allocated to this, we had to use what we had. And when I was at Columbia Regional Program, I ran a 20,000-square-foot equipment bank that we provided to four counties, and we're able to meet the needs of the children without and I didn't know that there was. I don't know that there was any litigation related to failure of any of the equipment. And so we were able to serve 23 school district 3SDs through this group of 400 children. And as a constituent of Representative Alyssa Kinney Geyer, I kind of shared this idea of where I came from in my work experience, and I was part of a couple of the governor's work groups for the CCO development. And one of the ideas that came up to me was they're looking for innovation or different to do within what framework we have. And I thought, well, it was working in the setting I was in, and how do we then migrate it into this other system that's going through its own change? And so with the help of Representative Thompson and Representative Kinney Geyer, we had this legislative work group to just kind of flesh out more of the concept that we were given last spring. So the work group membership included Representative Thompson, Representative Kinney Geyer, CCOs, Coordinated Care Organizations, the Oregon Health Authority, Developmental Disability Council, the Multnomah County Aging and People with Disabilities, and other public health advocates, and a physical therapist from OHSU-CDRC, who we share similar passions on how to support children, as well as legislative council and other community members. The work group came up with the following idea, that if it's possible, we would suggest to the committee that they support legislation which is to direct OHA DMAP with community input to develop a plan, promulgate rules and fee schedules to establish a credible, safe, functionally appropriate, durable medical equipment repurposing program that will this be a 3-year pilot project which will limit the geographic area and will be tightly related to the to local community partners, such as there is a furniture warehouse that already is starting to kind of look at how do they use equipment, medical equipment, but they want to look at how to actually establish a more credible form of doing this. We also like to, through this legislation, is to provide an alternate access method to provide safe and appropriate equipment to not only the CCO component, but also the fee-for-service non-covered CCO members as well. So this would stay within DMAP. It's expected that there will be an expansion of the population in the CCO or OHP, and we'd like to be able to support that expansion by keeping the cost down through reusing equipment. And we were asked that we use this bill, potential bill, as a proof of concept that repurposing is a good thing to do. And we would like to ask that there be voluntary participations by the CCOs. And something that came recently to us was that it actually takes shorter time to turn around if someone has in stock a used piece of equipment to be able to go from the physician, therapist, provider using repurposed equipment than to order new, because the lag time is 6 to 8 weeks for new equipment to come in. So we have this, you know, the delivery time and responsive time is better. So I thank you, and I hope that this committee will continue to support this citizen's effort to help better our state. And Are there any questions that, I don't know if I can answer them, but.
Let's let the other folks.
So this is Dean. My name is Dean Andretta. I'm here representing Willamette Valley Community Health, the CCO here in Marion and Polk County. We serve over 65,000 patients. We support this pilot project that will establish a system for repurposing durable medical equipment that is no longer useful or medically appropriate for the patient but may be safely repurposed for another member. The pilot supports our mission and of the triple aim by using Medicaid resources to their fullest extent and furthers our interest in providing the maximum flexibility under the global budget methodology. We greatly appreciate the efforts of Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer and her staff in bringing this concept to our attention and for our consideration, and we look very forward to working with this committee and members of the Oregon Legislature to bring this to fruition.
Thank you. Next.
Hi.
Hi.
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Kenny-Geyer, and members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Joey Rosano, and I represent families dealing with Rett syndrome. It's like having a child with autism, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, Parkinson's, and anxiety disorder all in one. Throw in some osteoporosis, scoliosis on a wheelchair, and you've got my 10-year-old Jade. I support a pilot project that would allow people with disabilities to donate and receive repurposed durable medical equipment, plus receive fitting and repair services. Jane depends on equipment every day, and my story will show you that sometimes we have to look outside the new durable medical equipment market to make sure that she has the right equipment to keep her safe. In addition to her chair, she has a stander, a gait trainer, a feeding chair, a bath chair, and an assistive communication device. You know, we have good insurance, but the normal copay of 20% can still leave you with thousands of dollars to pay just as a normal family. She does also receive Medicaid as part of the medically involved children's waiver, and that has saved our family. A few years ago, she was falling out of bed at night. Now, this is dangerous for any child, but she has osteoporosis, so it's particularly dangerous for her. We asked Jade's doctor for help. The doctor prescribed a sleep safe bed, which is different from the standard medical bed because it has more features to keep from falling out. It tilts up like a hospital bed, that kind of thing. We started working with our insurance company to get it, but it costs almost $7,000. Obviously, a request of this size takes time to work through the insurance system, but with each night in her old bed, she was risking serious injury. I had to do something to protect her while the insurance company was processing her bed prescription. We asked friends with kids of special needs where we could get a bed, but there was nowhere to go outside insurance. So I went to Facebook. Someone, another parent had posted on their free medical bed, and I was the first to snatch it up and say, I want it. So I had to drive an hour to Washington and pick up the used bed, which was dirty. Didn't have any installation instructions. It was way too big for Jade, and it had little boy stickers all over it. But I didn't care. I was thrilled to get this bed because it was better than the old one that she had. A couple of months later, our primary insurance authorized a sleep-safe bed, and of course, we were thrilled. So I went back on Facebook, and I offered the free medical bed to other families. That day, within hours, I had two families from Corvallis saying, please, I want it. It turns out those families knew each other, and so they decided between them that the one that was more medically involved would actually get it. So then I said to them, okay, but you have to drive up to me the hour to get it at your own expense, and I'm sorry there's no instructions and that kind of thing. Durable medical equipment such as beds are in such high demand that families feel like they hit the lottery when they get equipment passed on to them. The problem with this informal exchange system is the equipment often doesn't fit properly to the new child or it needs repair. Families have no place to take the equipment for fitting, modifications, or repairs, let alone transportation. Instead, they make do with the equipment that sort of works because it's better than having nothing at all. An equipment bank pilot project to repurpose medical equipment is such a great idea. It's really a no-brainer. It would save the state financially because the state could pay for the people to get the repurposed equipment at a fraction of the price of new equipment. Additionally, it would support families immensely by giving them access to equipment, fitting, modification, or repair services. Families would also benefit from having a place to donate their equipment instead of keeping it in their garage. Thank you so much for your support for this repurposed durable medical equipment pilot project. It will truly help people of all ages with disabilities.
Thank you very much.
I think you have one more here.
All right.
Chair Greenlake, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Family Care in Portland. Family Care is a CCO serving Tri-County, and we wholeheartedly support the proposed pilot to reuse and repurpose appropriate durable medical equipment. A program that safely cleans, repairs, or refurbishes used equipment no longer needed by the original recipient offers the dual opportunity to pass that equipment on to the next recipient while also the opportunity of potentially saving money for the whole system. Family Care and its fellow CCOs spend a substantial sum of money each year on durable medical equipment. For many DME items, the engineered useful life of the equipment far exceeds the actual need or the time it's needed by the original owner. This pilot program envisions a voluntary program to put this equipment back into circulation and realize the remaining benefit of its useful life. Approval of the pilot will help determine if a safe and cost-effective system to reuse and redistribute medical equipment can make the current amount of money we spend actually go farther, benefit more members, and provide more care. By its definition, durable medical equipment is not disposable equipment. This pilot offers a creative proposition directly responsive to the challenge we all face now of redesigning healthcare to improve individual health, enhance overall community health, and lower cost. Family Care encourages the community to support this pilot program and would look forward to working closely with its fellow CCOs and other community-based groups in this very promising endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Are there questions? Okay. Final. I'd just like to say, I don't think there's anybody, very few people my age, that doesn't have a walker and four canes in a closet somewhere. Not knowing what to do. I mean, this is much more profound than that, but
yeah.
It's, I mean, you know, after I had double knee surgery, I was laid up, had all these kind of things, I said, well, now what am I going to do? I've got a wheelchair, and I couldn't figure out what to do. It's really, I mean, it was that simple. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'd love Don Ross to come up also and maybe say a few words. Is there anyone else that was going to testify?
We're getting into
Jenny,
we have one more. And maybe I'll just say as you're coming up here, I'm just going to say a couple more things that weren't mentioned yet, although those were fantastic testimony. Fantastic. So thank you so much. I think Joey really hit on a lot of it. I wanted to say, first of all, in the materials, there are about four or five different letters of support for this. Ever since I first heard about it, the more we talk about it, the more this just seems like such a great idea. And, you know, as we try to save money in Medicaid, it used to be you cut services or you cut eligibility or you cut reimbursement rates. And the whole idea of transformation is to try to be innovative and deliver things in a more innovative way that allow us to provide actually greater services at an affordable cost. And so the idea of, you know, the right now what happens in Medicaid, and I didn't realize this, is that somebody, when you get equipment and you're on Oregon Health Plan, you actually own the equipment. And then
you send me out of the way.
And then maybe you sell it, you know, on Facebook, or you give it away on Facebook, or it goes in the landfill, or it goes in your attic or your basement. And so the starting idea is, how do we recirculate this so that more people can use it? Children, for instance, can only get a new wheelchair because it's so expensive, and Medicaid doesn't have a lot of dollars, can only get one every 5 years, and yet they're growing so fast. So if we had a warehouse, then they could start recirculating some of these things. And so, anyway, it's just been a fantastic. Fantastic. So, please tell us your story.
Okay. Chair Greenlake Committee, my name is Ruth McEwen. I live here in Salem, and I am very supportive of the idea of having a someplace for getting reused and not throwing it away. I myself wound up with my last chair giving it to Union Gospel Mission, and they fixed it up for someone else. But my concern is that in doing this, the only reason I got a new chair is because the people in the durable medical equipment supplier said they couldn't fix my old one, which I found out later was not so. And it was explained to me that they like to sell new equipment because they make more profit off of it than fixing old equipment. So I have a concern that even though it is a good idea of reusing the equipment, how are you going to get the repairs done that you need to take care of these equipment if the providers are not willing to work with you and to take care of that equipment? I wound up, I had a beautiful chair. I'd been in it for 9 years, and the motors finally went out. And they told me that the motors couldn't be replaced, and that I, the only thing they could do for me was to get me a new chair. So after almost 2 years of haggling back and forth with them and stock gaps of loaner chairs and different things, I finally wound up with the chair that I'm sitting in now, which does not fit me right. And I have gone for the last 3 years battling back and forth trying to get a chair to fit me the way my old chair fit me. And yet, they say now that I need a different kind of what they call an actuator, which makes parts of the chair move. But they can't provide it because it wasn't put on the original chair. And the only way I can get it now is if I pay $750 out of my own pocket for it. So I'm very concerned that unless you've got the durable medical providers on board with this program, that it's going to hurt. But I think that the whole idea of making things available to other people is a tremendous idea. And but the key thing that I would ask you to remember is that one size doesn't fit all. That there are individual needs with individual special presentations that will need to be customized or something to fit the, each of those people that are using this equipment. But make sure that you're on board with the providers that they're going to be willing to do this.
Do you have a comment on that?
No, I actually think that Don is the perfect person to respond to that. Because I think you're here mainly for technical. Is this doable? Is this going to solve some of the needs that you've been hearing about? So I think it's a good segue.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. My name is Don Ross, and I'm the Policy and Planning Manager and CCO Contract Admin Manager for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Oregon Health Authority. Our agency participated in this work group and providing technical assistance and information about what implementation of the idea that the group is proposing could work. There aren't any real stories I can share that are better than what the users of the equipment have already shared with you here today. But I would underscore that while they demonstrate that reuse occurs on some level right now with some success, what this group is proposing is that a system be set up to do this on a much larger scale and with repair and refurbishment and accessorizing that is necessary by trained technicians and assistive technology professionals. Also that an inventory or warehousing and database that all CCOs in the Medicaid delivery system and the agency for the fee-for-service population could go to in order to search and find this equipment and make arrangements for its transportation to wherever the need is at. I also thought it might be useful for the committee to be aware of sort of the size of the spend on these things and the population served. You already know a lot about the Medicaid population. We looked at some 2012 data. We have about approximately 20,000 individuals served in 2012 on the types of equipment that this work group believes could be repurposed. We also had $2.4 million in 2012 spent on the fee-for-service population alone. In 2012, we did not have reliable paid amounts on our managed care encounter data. We are collecting that now, but in 2012, we didn't have that data. But we estimate between 15 and 20 million spent statewide, system-wide per year on these items. And as other folks who have testified already indicated, the equipment is expensive new. It's very expensive, far more expensive than the cost of setting up a system to to fix it up and redistribute it to others who have need. The last thing I will add to what you've already heard is that for people whose condition is progressive and changes often, or for children who are developing and growing, their need for the specifics of their equipment can change more often than the coverage criteria allow for replacement of that equipment. So current Medicaid coverage criteria that my agency uses allows for replacement every 5 years. And if an individual is 5 years old, their needs are going to change several times before they turn 10. And this might make that possible so that we could make new or modified equipment available more often without increasing the state or federal expenditure on that equipment.
Great.
Can I say two more things?
I'd like you to say three more things.
Okay,
I'd like you to say the two you're going to say briefly, and then give us a couple minutes. We have four LCs that we're going to be submitting.
Okay.
If you could describe the LC on this one as your third thing.
Okay, great. Well, first I just want to acknowledge the people that were on this, and the committee kind of kept growing. We kept thinking who else should be at the table, and again, we know it's just a start, because if this is passed, there will be a rulemaking process that will be open, and more people can come to the table. So if you're interested, by all means, hopefully support this and be at the table when we work on it. So Brian Niebert was here on behalf of Oregon Health Authority, of course with Don Ross. Lori Freeman sat in so she could really understand. She's legal counsel, so she could really understand what the group was getting at in writing up the LC. David Comidji, of course. Leslie Satin, who I see in the back there, who's with Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Christy Wood, who's the executive director of the community warehouse that you referred to as the furniture warehouse that actually already is doing something like this out in Hillsboro. David Olson, who's with OHSU, the CDRC. Peggy Bray is the director of the Multnomah County Aging and Disability Service. Janet Meyer is the other CCO person that was here for HealthShare. So we had three CCO representatives that cover the Tri-County area, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, as well as Marion Polk County, because we thought in a pilot we wanted to try to see, you know, transportation. How do you start going up and down the I-5 corridor? Part of this is to try to get beyond a small area so that you can really reach out to people who have distinct disabilities that may not be served by your small geographic area. So having transportation be a part of this pilot was important to us, but we didn't want to go statewide. We wanted to wrap our arms around it. And then we actually invited in Pacific Source because we wanted to see, you know, is this the kind of thing that private insurance would be ultimately interested in, if those without insurance or those who have private insurance might eventually want to have a place where they could try to get reused equipment as well. So Marion Blankenship and Pamela Levitt on behalf of Pacific Source. And then a couple of community people who heard about it, Matt McPherson, who's an assistant technology professional, Mike McNichol, who's a health advocate, heard about this, were interested in, and also came. So that was one thing. The other was just I was going to say the LC itself would be, it's actually in the material, so you can see what the concept is that we've passed on to Lori Freeman, and hoping this is a committee bill, and along with laying this out, you know, a pilot project that would develop an inventory system, a warehouse, service to clean, sanitize, repair, make sure that it's really safe. That was one of the things that Joey talked about, where it's so informal now, we don't know if what people are getting are really fitted or safe. System-wide communication about procedures and regulations, publicity, getting the word out about this, and then assessment and metrics. We really want a proof of concept after 3 years, so that we can see if, like in Kansas and Oklahoma, where this has been done, and there was a 3-to-1 saving. Every dollar that the state put into this, $3 were returned in savings. If this can really help us extend services at an affordable cost. So that, also we are going to be looking for $50,000 to help kind of get up the database and start up costs for this kind of effort. So that will be the LC.
Jim will write a check.
Anything you would like to add?
Just briefly addressing Ruth's point, I've been doing some of this work for several years because of the ability of my aged mother-in-law to volunteer me to do it. And it is amazing how many replacement parts by model you can get on the internet now, if you know where to go. So a lot of the issues on finding pads or walker tips or you know, if things are broken, it's amazing how much of it's really available over the internet.
Motor.
And the, yeah, the motor too. That you might not be able to get through a new equipment retailer who is trying to sell new equipment. But so I think there's a lot of potential here once we get something like this set up. And the other thing is the amount of equipment that is available. I've been out in our community a lot in Polk County, and the thrift shops, retirement center, all of these places have a pile of this stuff that people have donated or walked away from and whatnot. They'd love to donate it to somebody, but they don't have a name. So I think the collection part is going to be very significant, to have community centered collection people identified to sweep through and collect and transport this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be done by volunteers.
Okay, well, you guys have done an incredible job. Thank you very much for your work. We'll have this LC process, and we'll see where it goes. I'll close the public hearing on durable medical equipment. And just, I don't think I have to open it, but I want to move into the discussion of a very, very brief discussion on the LCs we're talking about introducing. Listen, Jim and I have narrowed it down to four. We only can submit three. We'll submit three, and I'll take whichever one of the others is. If you want to submit an LC, you can submit it under your name, if under your two, your quota of two. We can then introduce it as a committee bill. So it, the limit on, is on how many LCs you can ask for, not how many committee bills we can have in this session. So if you have something you would like to submit, submit it as an LC, and then we'll bring it in as a committee bill if you would like us to do that rather than do it as an individual bill. And one of them is is a durable medical equipment. We have, Nikki, do you want to talk about one? Claudia? 2 or 3 minutes, and who's the third one?
John Mullen.
Oh, John Mullen, yes, absolutely. John, why don't you guys join us and tell us just about 2 minutes for the committee's information on what LCs you're proposing.
Well, we heard the e-prescribing in September, so this
right.
is a refresher, and we heard from John's group.
Right, he's got a new version on that,
right.
too.
Right.
And I think Claudia has a new version over what we heard as well.
I'm not sure if the House is familiar with calling.
We'll see.
We will.
In any order. Alphabetical, by height, whatever.
Oh, by height.
I'll go first. Nikki Terziev, on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. The LC in question, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for considering this, of course. The LC in question is a bill that was introduced very late in the last regular session, and the only reason it didn't get very far is because when it left here and went to your other chamber here in the building, it met with some strict rule enforcement and
a deadline
and went into a policy committee which was no longer active. So we'd like to bring it back. This is a technical fix, and actually you heard from myself and Rob Bovet before his new position in the AOC, and Gary Schnabel, who is the executive director of the Board of Pharmacy, and we spoke with you all about making sure that Class 2 drugs along with the rest of the drugs were eligible for e-prescribe. This will connect us to federal level regulations and provide public safety and customer convenience, and should be an easy bill to see.
And it was an oversight in the drafting of
correct,
the,
sir.
The bill we passed. Are there any questions for Nikki?
Thank
Claudia?
You.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm co-director of government relations for Multnomah County. Thank you for considering this legislative concept and the opportunity to explain it to you. This particular legislative concept builds on Senate Bill 457A with the -5 amendments from the regular 2013 session. It was also a late in the session bill and was primarily worked on by the Sheriff's Association. It's something that was put forward by them. This concept would require that health insurance companies pay for health care that's provided to those people who are insured by them and are incarcerated in county jails. So most, if not all, health insurers in Oregon have exclusions in their policies for people who are incarcerated.
Claudia, are you talking about everybody or about the pre-adjudicated?
I'm talking about everyone at this point. So it's anyone that is insured by a private insurance company and continues to have their premium paid but are incarcerated in county jail. So the even though the premiums are continue to be paid, the insurers will not cover the health care costs while the person is incarcerated. And so currently the health care for these people who are incarcerated is paid for by the taxpayers. This concept would remedy the cost shift by requiring health insurers to continue to pay for health care for their insured population, whether that care is provided in the community or in jail. And that's pretty much a quick little two-minute summary. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yes. Just why is it that the insurers don't continue to provide coverage when someone's incarcerated if the premium's still being paid?
I think, Mr. Chair,
I guess,
Representative Conger, I think that's probably a question for the insurers. I would hate
historical.
To speak on behalf of them.
It's always been an exclusion of people in custody. I remember looking at some policies as part of a project I was doing from 1960, and they all excluded people under state or under state control, like in state hospitals or incarcerated. The really egregious part of this is that people who are there pre-adjudicated, that really doesn't make any sense because they could be out on bail,
right,
and it would be covered, but because they're in a jail, it doesn't. So we could ultimately think of a compromise as we go downstream on this and at least start with the pre-adjudicated population. I mean, it makes no sense. There's no basis for that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could add one more comment. I just left Association of Oregon Counties. They're having a meeting in Eugene this week, and they have introduced a resolution that they will be voting on in about 45 minutes. But I can tell you that the commissioners that you all represent are very strongly in support of this particular legislative concept.
They don't want to
pay. Yeah, I don't understand that at all. Claudia,
until they find out how complicated billing is, it may be a different story, by the way. Former county commissioner, I can assure you.
John?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Thank you for this opportunity. You've heard me testify in the past about the basic health program option under the Affordable Care Act. I'm here on behalf of a coalition of groups. We're now calling ourselves the Inclusion Affordability Innovation Coalition. And basically, just a very quick reminder about the basic health program is that it's allowable under the Affordable Care Act for those people who are between 138 and 200% of the federal poverty level. The principal issue is about affordability, that we know that a number of lower income people are going to have a hard time with affordability. This allows states to operate a Medicaid CHIP-like program to serve those people up to 200% of the federal poverty level. Importantly, it also allows us to serve people who are legally residing immigrants that are barred under federal law from Medicaid for a five-year period. So the ACA allows for this. The issue right now and the legislative concept is basically to direct the Oregon Health Authority to commission a study to take a look at what is the feasibility for Oregon to engage in the idea of committing to a basic health program option. Had the opportunity back in August to meet with the chair and vice chairs and a coalition of people to talk about all of the issues. Cover Oregon and Oregon Health Authority was also represented there. We think that this is the right direction to take a look at an innovation that might be possible for Oregon that will help with affordability. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yeah, it's a very simple statement now that simply asks them to do that in time for us to reconsider whether we want to ask them to apply for it in the 2015 time.
So this is, John, just, I have forgotten our conversations about this, I think. So this is taxpayer-funded health plan for people who are 138% to 200% of the federal poverty level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, the origin of this comes from the state of Washington, and Senator Maria Cantwell inserted it into the ACA because in the state of Washington, they had great success with being able to cover people of up to 200% of the federal poverty level. One of the things that is an unknown at this point in time is how many people between 138 and 200% of federal poverty level will apply. So in answer to your question specifically, this is a Medicaid CHIP-like program, and it would operate side-by-side with the Oregon Health Plan.
It would be funded by the subsidy that would be available to these people, plus a premium in some cases, right?
Thank you. Yes, it's at 95% pegged at what the cost would be for otherwise for people being on the exchange. So in other words, if we didn't have it, people would still be eligible for the exchange, and they would have the ability to get the tax credits. This simply turns the tax credits into the dollars that come to the state to create this program that is essentially more affordable, accessible, and it also involves the legal immigrant population.
Okay, I have a lot more questions.
Yeah, well, we'll have time.
I think
And it's a very simple bill. It says study it. Okay, thank you all very much. Pending that, is there anything else that anybody wants to bring before us? And remember, if you want to request a bill and have it submitted as a committee bill, that's fine.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if you want, you can ask the governor why he kept running all the commercials and for the exchange, knowing it didn't work. So he could have saved that money and ran them later when it was working. Be a good question for the governor why he chose to do that.
I love it when he didn't vote for it, so he gets to say, "I told you so." I have to try the damn fax machine all day long instead, and I voted for it.
That's convenient for you. I have
voted for the fax machine.
Ma'am, I have a solution for that. Walk it over, for God's sakes. What do you need a fax for?
Yeah, there's this thing called when you're doing feeding tubes in between, you don't just walk it over.
Send a cab.
Yeah, take my 19-page cover.
We are
big bucks.